Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Welcome back, and hope that you are blessed wherever you are. It's a beautiful day here, and it's a great day to talk about the Torah portion. And this is a particularly interesting one, and as you've probably already gathered from what's been discussed this morning, perhaps a fairly difficult one as well, in the sense that there are a whole lot of speculations and midrash and other kind of things that surround this one. So what I want to do is a couple things just to get us started. One, I don't often do this because I don't necessarily always have a title for the teaching, but I do this morning. And I'm going to borrow it from mathematics and engineering since that's my own background. Some of you have heard this term. I've mentioned it before, but I want to make sure that it's real clear today when I'm what I'm talking about and why I think this is the right way to discuss this. It's called the necessary but not sufficient condition. And that theme is going to show up a couple of times, I will suggest, in this Torah portion. In mathematics, you'll hear something described as a necessary but not sufficient condition. In other words, this has to be true, but it ain't necessarily enough. It's a minimum condition, and there may be more things that are also required. When we get to the part about the kashrut, what is food and what is not food, you'll see that coming home in spades. In other words, when it comes to an animal that walks on the land, it is necessary that it has a split hoof, but it is not sufficient. It has to also chew the cud. And if it chews the cud alone, that too is a necessary but not sufficient condition. You got to have both or it's no sale. Okay, so we're going to see the same thing in some other areas. And this is one of those things that ends up being a little bit on the subtle side too. Because as you also know, one of the things that I harp on, why? Because Scripture does. We are not to add to nor subtract from. And I will suggest to you, and we'll talk about that again as we go through this, that is particularly appropriate when it comes to the priesthood. Those of the Levites, and later on, presumably, those that would proclaim themselves to be priests, or priests and kings, or whatever it may be, whether they really are or not, if they don't understand the minimum but not sufficient conditions, and then furthermore, they don't understand the subtleties about not adding to or subtracting from, we got a problem. And we're going to see how some of those problems manifest themselves today. So again, that's part one, necessary but not sufficient condition. And then part two is kind of, let's go through this, because this is one of those interesting portions as well, where I think whoever it was that divided it up did a tremendous job of saying these things go together, chapters 9 and 10 and 11 of Leviticus. And I know as you read through it, you think, what? What has some of the stuff in this portion got to do with some of the other stuff in this portion? It starts out, for example, with something that looks like it might have gone with the end of the last several portions. All of this jazz about Aaron making the offerings and the sacrifices and the burnt offerings and so forth. We've talked about that for several weeks now. All of these things that were involved with setting up and then building and then consecrating and preparing the Mishkan. So it starts with that. Then, of course, we have the story of the two sons of Aaron, what happens to them, which we'll spend some time on. And then this thing that kind of sort of seems to appear out of the blue, why are we all of a sudden talking about food? And what has that got to do with all of this? And again, I'm going to suggest that it's a perfect progression, and that when we look at it the way that I will again suggest we do, this idea of necessary but not sufficient conditions and understanding the other nuances here, all of a sudden it fits. One other note, I guess, as we go into this. Normally what I do on Erev Shabbat, on Friday night, at the teachings we do in the Shabbat Shalom Mesa Room, is I will always try to go through the Torah portion essentially from beginning to end. And at least to some extent, not always in quite as much detail. A lot of times I'll focus in more detail on Shabbat. But to at least go through the whole thing. And then on the presentation that we're doing this morning on Shabbat, I might tend not to do that in as much completeness. And in this particular case, for reasons that I've just already said, I do feel like we've got to start at the beginning, even though we're going to focus on a couple specifics. So, chapter 9, Parsha Shmini, begins, "It came to pass on the Shmini day, the eighth day, that Moses called to Aaron and his sons, the elders of Israel, and he said, do these things." Now, there's a lot of detail as to what it is that they did. Take the burnt off a bull calf for a sin offering and a ram for a burnt offering. without blemish, offer them before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and so forth. But the thing I want to emphasize, literally, that appears a number of times in chapter 9, it kind of sets the stage here, is just this idea. What Moshe did when he commanded them, they did when they walked in obedience. For example, verse 5, that chapter says, "And they brought that which Moshe commanded before the tent of meeting. And Moses said, 'This is the thing which Yahuwah has commanded that you should do, that the glory, the Shekinah of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh should appear to you.'" And verse 7 says, "Moses said unto Aaron, do these things, draw near the altar, offer your sin offering, and do these things." And the last line is, "As Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has commanded." So Aaron did it. Over and over again, we get this theme, they did as they were commanded. Why is that important? Well, because then we come to the next part of the story. The part where I've already said that there is let's just say lots and lots of discussion, maybe even disagreement, as to why certain things happened. The last part, however, of chapter 9 that leads us there is verse 24. "There came forth fire." Came forth. Yatzah is the root word there. "There came forth fire." And the fire word here is ish. Or esh, I guess, is probably a little bit closer pronunciation. And it's actually a pretty similar word, if you think about it, to man. Ish, esh. Very similar root. Isn't that interesting? This next portion, I'm going to add in one more little bit of introduction to this. Kind of sort of the way that we set the stage so that we're clear on what has happened, what is fixing to happen. This has to do with fire. It has a lot to do with fire. And as I'm saying that, I remember again, last night I drew a blank for a second, but the famous quote from George Washington, and it may or may not be true, but at least it's attributed to him, is he's talking about fire. He says, "It is a dangerous servant and a fearful master." And I think that fits. Because the last line again, "And there came forth fire from before Yahuwah. This consumed," the fire, "the burnt offering and the fat that was upon the altar. People saw it, they shouted, they fell on their faces." The very next thing we hear is about Nadab and Abihu, sons of Aaron. Each of them took his censer and they put fire in them, laid incense and offered this fire. Now they've got a different name here, strange fire, foreign fire, unauthorized fire. There's a lot of ways that that gets translated and rendered in these various verses. But the key is right here at the end of that verse, "which he," Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, "had not commanded them." We just finished hearing about all these things that they did exactly as commanded. Now here it's telling us they did something that was not commanded. But wait a second. Stop. Isn't that okay? They're just trying to be good dudes, right? They're excited. At least that seems to be the implication. There are those that would differ, and we'll talk about that in a second because it helps to make the point here. But at least the general understanding of most of the folks who look at this throughout history is that these are genuinely well thought of, smart individuals that for whatever reason, you know, they're not doing anything that the church hasn't done for 1700 years. They're just trying to be really, really good priests. And if he says do X, they're going to do X plus Y, right? They're going to go further. They know about this idea of a necessary but not sufficient condition, so they're going to go and add to it. They're going to bring fire. Hey, God just sent down some fire. Why don't we bring some of our own fire? It's cool, right? Maybe not. Again, we'll go through some of the alternative explanations here in a second. But the key thing is what Scripture tells us clearly. They brought forth fire, which he had not commanded them. And now, the response, this is the shocker, "There comes forth fire from before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and it devoured." It consumed them. It was a consuming fire. They died before Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. We have a couple of explanations. Moshe says to Aaron, "This is what Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh has spoken. Them that are nigh unto me, those that come into my presence before me, I will be set apart. I will be sanctified. Before all the people, I will be glorified." Aaron kept his mouth shut. He held his peace. All right, let's talk a little bit about what may be going on here. As I've already mentioned, there are three kinds of fire that are discussed. I like some of the ways you'll hear this described. First one is this fire from heaven. It's also called sometimes a fire of favor. The last verse of chapter 9, it's the one that came forth from before Elohim and consumed the burnt offering, says yet another translation. Then you got the unauthorized fire, the strange fire, the foreign fire that were offered by the two sons of Aaron. And this was that which, quote, he had not instructed them to offer, verse 1 of the next chapter. And then you have the counter fire, the thing that came from him this time. You brought your strange stuff, here comes the real fire from him, and it consumed them so that they died before him. This certainly does seem to be a bit problematic. Now, at this point, I'm going to point out one other thing. Scripture tells us specifically the reason. They were killed, it says, because he had not commanded them to bring this fire. Seems simple enough. So why all the alternative explanations? Well, back to this concept of necessary but not sufficient conditions. There'll be another term that you'll sometimes hear in a court of law, contributing factors. You know what? When you put all these things together, which was the straw that broke the camel's back? There may have been a really big log that finally brought the camel down, but there was a lot of other straw that had been loaded on this camel first, right? All of those things contributed. We can certainly identify the one that said, all right, that's it. Time out. But there may be other ones. I'm going to point to the difference here now between this idea of a necessary but not sufficient condition and explicit obedience. So we've got a number of potential concepts to talk about. And let's also talk about some of the other things that are offered up by the sages, by the midrash, by the rabbis, and by the priests and the preachers and everybody else's as to what was really going on here. I like the way that this one summary, this is from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. Some of you know he's a fellow that I read fairly regularly because somehow or other, the way his mind works just seems to kind of click with the things that resonate with me too. There are a couple of others that I enjoy. There are, you know, lots of other people that we could all point to and say, hey, I've learned from this guy, I've learned from that guy. But over time, we'll find that there are certain ones that just seem to click with us more than others, perhaps. Anyway, here's how he puts it in talking about this concept of different kinds of fire by saying, look at this week's Torah portion. The shock is immense. And he notes that, you know, for a long time now, this is the longest prelude leading up to this in the whole Torah. We have all these preparations we've been reading about for the moment at which God would bring his presence to rest in the midst of the people. Now, that's an important point, too. And I'm going to later on in a minute here, I'm going to throw in some other items to the mix that will fit with that one. The big buildup. It's all about Elohim, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, bringing his presence into this place that has been prepared, this special place. Kind of like a garden within the world, if you want to think of it that way. And he is going to put his glory amongst the people. We have five portions, Teruma, Tetzaveh, Kitasa, Vayechel, and Pekudai. We've been through those for 5 weeks and a little bit more previous to this, all describing the instructions just for putting this Mishkan, this tabernacle, this sanctuary together. And then we have two more, Vayikra and Zav, the last couple, detailing the offerings that are going to be brought there. All is now ready, he notes. 7 days, the priests have been set apart, consecrated into their office. Now here we are, the eighth day. The service of the Mishkan will finally begin. Everybody is excited. The glory of Elohim has been revealed to all the people. The offering's been consumed by that fire from heaven. And just as we think we're ready for the exciting climax, here comes chapter 10, the first verses. Nadab and Abihu, they take their censers, they put fire, their own fire, strange fire into them, they add incense, and they brought that unauthorized fire before Elohim. We know what happens. Celebration turns to tragedy, and the two eldest sons of Aaron die. Now, here's again where we get so many explanations. We've even heard some other ones, additional plausible possibilities this morning already. But let me lay out at least a half a dozen that are kind of making the rounds. Here's the way Rabbi Sacks puts it first. They died because, they entered the Holy of Holies. Not supposed to do that. They were not wearing the requisite clothing. Yeah, okay. Now that's at least a contributing factor. Perhaps they took fire from the kitchen or somewhere else. Not the altar. Well, maybe. They did not consult Moshe and Aaron. This one seems to be a really popular theory, particularly Moshe. In other words, were they usurping the authority of Moshe, doing things on their own rather than going to him and saying, what should we do specifically here? They didn't even consult one another. At least we don't see that description. To some folks, all of that can be lumped into this category of saying, well, they were guilty of hubris. Maybe they were impatient to assume this leadership role. Others even add to it, hey, you know, we're not told that they were married. That, too, would indicate that maybe they were above such things. They were too focused. They were too set on themselves. There are even people that speculate, well, that their sin had to do with Mount Sinai when they ate and drank in the presence of Yah, you know, so forth. A lot of other possible explanations. And he doesn't even list a couple of the others that are popular among, for example, Christians, particularly some of the Baptist persuasion. Hey, weren't they drunk? Let's not forget they had some wine. They were drunk. By the way, that one has some support in Scripture because we hear that commandment being after, that prohibition being offered up after the fact. After the fact. Now, is it fair? As if fair matters, but is it fair for Yod-Heh Vav-Heh to punish them for something that they hadn't even been warned about yet? You'll get lots and lots of discussion, even argument on that topic. Now, here's how I'm gonna make sure that we're clear on this. I'm laying out possibilities here. I'm gonna show you how I would connect the dots after laying out a whole bunch of dots and admitting clearly there's a whole bunch of ways to connect these things. Maybe you just draw a big line and color it all in and connect them all together. But I do think it's kind of informative. You can even go to the midrash that Paul offers in the apostolic writings and say, wait a minute, there's no sin imputed when there's no instruction yet in place. If you look at it, it's in the book of Romans where he talks about, before the law is given, and I don't like that word as you all know, before there's been any instruction laid out, you can't punish the kid for doing something that he hadn't been told not to do yet. But then again, there would be those that say, look, isn't it obvious? You don't get drunk and go into the presence of Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. By the way, that's part of the reason why I don't really think that that's part of what was going on here. Although, again, it does come out later that you're not supposed to have anything. As a pilot, I'm used to the prohibitions. You don't drink at all before you get ready to fly an airplane. Period. That's just makes good sense. And you wouldn't think people would have to be told that. But, again, there you go. There is a whole nother bunch of stuff, and I do tend to kind of fall into this camp a little bit anyway, that this was an overzealous, well-intentioned act. You look at Pinchas, he was zealous, he acted without the approval of Moshe, but he was rewarded with a covenant of peace. It would seem, if you will, that somehow or other, if nothing else, when we step back and look at this thing from a big picture standpoint, we got a couple guys here that act in a sense of zealousness, and it was not well received. And then we have this other act by Pinchas that would seem to violate a pretty significant stricture. Thou shalt not murder. And he goes in and he runs Cozbi and her lover through. And he's rewarded with a covenant of peace. Problematic, if nothing else. Maybe it has to do with the fire, too. We got three kinds of fire that are described in this portion that are specifically important. Maybe if you want to divide it a different way, there's really only two kinds of fire. The first and the last come from Yod-Heh Vav-Heh himself. The middle one is the one that comes from man. Two fires come down from God. One fire comes up from man. Wrong. Reset. Maybe. I like a summary that I saw. Now, this is from one of the people that and it's, by the way, it's Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. his take seems to be along the lines of, you know, they got overzealous. Maybe they were acting outside the sphere of authority. And I am not going to disagree with that. And the way he puts it was this. Nadab and Abihu were, they were surely great people. The trouble was, they believed they were great people. In other words, he's kind of falling a little bit into the hubris camp. Now, with respect to all of these explanations and others, he makes a pretty good point, too. If you look at the Torah and read it closely, just do a search for the references to the deaths of Nadab and Abihu. You'll find a bunch of places. Here's a list. Leviticus 10:2. Leviticus 16:1, Numbers 3:4, and Numbers 26:61, as well as the reference to their presence on Mount Sinai, all of which would seem to support one or more of these contributing factors. But he believes, and I will echo this, that the key, and of course, can't argue with it because it's right smack there in Scripture, is that it was not commanded. They brought fire, strange fire, unholy fire, even if you want to say it that way, foreign fire, that was not commanded by Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But wait a minute. Okay, back again to this necessary but not sufficient condition thing. See, here's a part that's hard for us to kind of wrap our heads around. We're used to saying, okay, he says do this. I did it. What's the problem? I did it. Now you're getting upset at me because I did more. Ow, this is so hard. Wait a minute. Are you wanting to be a priest? Or are you wanting to walk in obedience? Ah, you see, we can't deny it. There does seem to be a difference here when it comes to the priesthood. As a matter of fact, if you look at the Midrash, and I find this somewhat comforting because I look at my own predisposition, I'm a big picture kind of guy. The details tend to be something that, I see the details once, great. I'll study the details. They help make it. But I'm the big picture kind of guy. And I get bored going through the same details over and over and over and over again. I'm better suited to be a prophet than a priest is the bottom line here. Okay? You got the detail, folks? For those of you that know Myers-Briggs, it would be the ISTJs. They follow the rules. They say, here's how we do it. A, B, C, D. Okay? If I'm going to fly a plane, I know the checklist is important. I'll go through the checklist every single time. And maybe that's the same way it is when you're getting ready to go into the Holy of Holies. Go before the presence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And I am not going to argue with that. That is the essence of it. The priests go into the presence. They are commanded certain things. We're going to see those things in this portion. Teach the difference between the tahor and the tameh, the set apart, the holy, and the unclean, the profane. The rules for the priests are very specific. If you don't like it, don't be a priest. By the way, not adding to and subtracting from is a big key part of that. Are we starting to see it? It's one thing to talk about necessary but not sufficient conditions. And it's another thing to say, when I tell you how to walk, you are to walk this way and only this way. No, it's a necessary condition. Don't subtract from it, for crying out loud. But neither add to it. Quick digression here. If I go back and I look at the two ditches that I see in human history that are really described with two competing religions that have fought with each other for the better part of two millennia at this point. You got rabbinic Judaism, Phariseeism, take your pick, call it what you want, on the one hand, and Roman Catholicism and all of its protesting variants on the other hand. And one of them is the add to religion, that's Pharisaic Judaism, and the other is the subtract from religion. Pharisees will say, okay, I know it says this. Here are the necessary but not sufficient conditions. We got a whole bunch of other things we're adding to those. We got fences upon fences upon fences. He wrote half a dozen, maybe a dozen tops rules for Shabbat. We got 1,700 more. We're adding to like there's no tomorrow. Meanwhile, you got the Catholics. We don't like the stuff God wrote. We're getting rid of all of that. Okay? He said there are certain things that aren't food. We're going to say no fish on Fridays. He says priests are supposed to marry. Whatever I said. Yeah, no meat on Fridays. Meatless Fridays. Have fish only. Where did they get that? Who knows? They made it up. Okay? He says keep Sabbath. Now we're going to change the day. And so forth. In other words, he says do this. They say don't even bother. Subtracting from on the one hand, adding to on the other. If you're going to be priests and kings, you're going to walk the narrow path and veer not to the right or to the left. This is what, you know, you've heard me hammer this week after week and literally month after month. We got to learn to do both. Know what the necessary but not sufficient conditions are. Learn those, start there, and then learn to walk in real obedience to Him. And it is particularly important if we're going to be a priest. If you want to go into His presence, that's the key thing here. I will suggest that it is particularly important. All right. That brings me to one more story that will help set the stage for the rest of where I want to go this morning. For this, I credit something I just saw this week from Rabbi David Foreman. He's another one of my favorites. I've mentioned his books on a couple of occasions. And he even credits a student whose name I've forgotten for having pointed this out to him. But I think it's really cool. Now, some of you know, one of the things that I like, it's just kind of the way my mind works. I'm, like I said, a big picture kind of guy. Look at the pictures in Scripture. I like to step back and say, isn't that neat? And sometimes, especially in the Hebrew language, you'll see sets of words appear. And the more you begin to appreciate the nuances there, the more you see, look at that. That's the same sets of words elsewhere. This is, by the way, how I first discovered David Foreman's book. Because I noticed that Genesis 3, where it's talking about the word teshuka, your desire, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to Chava after the unfortunate incident of eating something she should not have ate, was your desire, your teshuka will be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And then no less than a chapter later, we come across almost the same words being used from Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh talking to Cain. Sin lies at the door. Its desire is for you, but you can rule over it. You see the pattern similarity there? So I thought, that is really cool. I started doing all this study, and I found this great book written by Rabbi David Foreman. And he had noticed the same thing, got into a lot of detail. So no surprise, I guess, that when it comes to that kind of pattern matching, I would see his name coming up again. And here's one of those this time. It has to do with, step back and look at this picture. And I went through this in some detail last night. I'm going to go through a little bit faster today, just so that we can cut to the chase and get to the picture. But I will suggest, if it interests you, go ahead and study it some more. And you'll find that it's really kind of fascinating. You can look up his presentation, too, where he goes into more detail on it than I am. But it starts with some parallels. All right? For one, the time frame. This begins on the eighth day. You got 7 days. And then on the eighth day, our story here, curtain opens. What else happens? Well, we have this blessing that's given. And there's been a lot of discussion about that aspect of it today. They take and they give. They're taking things from the people. They're making offerings. They're giving those things before the altar. Then we have this, the crux, right? The dramatic confluence of the story would be the center of the book, where the bad thing happens, the sin, if you will. This thing that was not commanded. Nadab and Abihu bring fire that was not commanded. And then, of course, the consequence of that. They are consumed. David Foreman points out that literally the word that is used there is eaten. That word that gets rendered in English as the fire consumed them is the same Hebrew word for to eat something. Hint, hint. When it comes to the pattern that we're looking for, that's going to be key. You might not see it in the English, but you'll see it in the Hebrew. What happens next? Well, death. Death and dying. Are you beginning to see the pattern? And finally, the sixth element, their clothing. Bring them out of there. They stay in the clothing that they were in. All right. Well, let's break the tension. What he says is, if you've noticed, this looks a whole lot like the pattern that we see in Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. You got something that happens after the first full 7 days. There's a blessing, lots of blessing. There are things that are taken and given. There are things that are done that are not commanded. That one should be obvious. There is this consuming that happens. And then there is this dying that happens on the same day, at least. And then finally, there's this issue of clothing. They try to make some clothing to cover their nakedness, and the Creator of the universe says, nope, here. And He gives them some skins. So he asks the obvious question. When you see those parallels, are we talking about another Tree of Knowledge story? Hadn't thought about that. It's another explanation for all of these things that we see in this story here. Maybe it's something even that Nadab and Abihu were smart enough they should have figured out on their own. Is that a possibility? Certainly could be. Are they looking for hidden knowledge? Are they looking, well, eat this and you can be like God? You want to be one with God? You want to be like God? Hey, that fruit, it looks pretty good there. Consume that. What are they doing? They're doing something they weren't commanded. Out of zeal? What is it that Adam and Eve are doing? Their zeal, you could argue at least, is they want to be like God. Isn't that a kind of forgivable thing? Doesn't everybody kind of want to be like God? If we really love Him and if we see this fire coming up and we're fixing to go into the Holy of Holies and to see a whole bunch of things that mere mortal people can't see because we've been anointed as priests and we spent 7 days getting ready for this, we are so rearing at the bit that we're fixing to go, oh yeah, you can't hold me back in there. I want to be like God. I want to be one with God. I want my fire to mingle with His fire. I'm going to come before Him in a way that He has not commanded, not because I want to be rebellious? No, but I just want to go above and beyond the call of duty here. Wrong. You come before my presence in the way that I have commanded you. Necessary but not sufficient conditions won't cut it. Not in this ballpark, boys. You walk in perfect obedience. You do what I tell you to do when I tell you to do it in the way that I tell you to do it. You ought to know better. You're at a place now where you ought to know better. Does it, by the way, begin to resonate to make sense that if there's a single failing throughout the human condition that kind of resonates here? Look at the sin of the golden calf. We are going to worship God the way we have been taught that He ought to like being worshipped. Isn't that what Catholicism does? Oh, we got to bring all these pagan conditions on in. Going to bring more people to God. Going to bring them because they love their Easter. Because they love their Christmas. They love their Mithra's birthday. We're going to say, come on in. The water's fine. Bring it to God. He knows your heart. He accepts all of that. If we're supposed to be priests and kings, or just priests for crying out loud, we ought to know better than to add to or subtract from what's written. Teach the difference between the clean and the unclean. If you can't do that, you're not fit to be a priest. In other words, you've heard this before, right? This is kind of now beginning to fall into another familiar pattern. Do it the way He says, not the way you think He ought to want it to be done. He doesn't like your pagan offerings. He doesn't like what man says He ought to like. Whether it's Ishtar Sun God Day, morning services, or golden calves named Yahweh and offered up to Him. Do it my way. Who is to be Lord here? Who is to be husband here? Who is to be king here? And who is to walk in obedience? Do you not understand the most basic thing? And if you can't understand the most basic thing, don't, for crying out loud, think that you're fit to be a priest to me. We do need to subjugate our own understanding, in other words, to His. I'm going to close this aspect with a couple of other pretty great comments from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. I'm combining some of these things together because, again, when it comes to this idea of necessary but not sufficient conditions, and of adding to and subtracting from, and these other things that are contributing factors, I do think there's a lot of merit in all of them. Even the don't get drunk and go into my presence part. Hey, you ought to know better than that too. Here's how he puts it, and I think this is pretty well put. That, this idea of the passionate love of the Creator for His creatures is what rings through in this story. You know, and he even points out, ex-chianity, that's the way I like to refer to it in this context, been saying for a long time, he's a mean old man. He's that old God of the Old Testament, that smiter of all those people who come before Him. Now we got Jesus, we got love, we don't need that old God anymore. Let's not forget, He is still Master. He's the one that sent all of the prophets. And however you want to slice it, whether you believe that his son came down and in what form, all of that kind of stuff, the key is still everybody who speaks in his name, without exception, they speak what it is that the creator of the universe, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, has said to speak. I come to do my father's will, says Yahushua, period. Back to the story here, the way that Rabbi Sachs puts it. This is the function of the Kadosh, the set apart. It's about leaving the I part, the man part, behind, if we're going to encounter him in his glory, in his Shekinah. The function of the Kadosh is the point at which the I am is silent. Remember, we even see Aaron in his grief, keeping silent in the face of the overwhelming presence of the true I am, in the sense of the third person, it's the there is. That is what Nadab and Abihu forgot, he notes, that to enter holy space or holy time requires humility, the total renunciation of your own human initiative and desire in the face of his. It's about what submission is. And that cannot be overestimated, he says. When we begin to confuse God's will with our will, and I'm going to say it this way, real bluntly, folks, because most people won't. Whether we think we're rabbis and that 51 rabbis override the will of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and 49 others, or the Pope has his red phone and he picks it up and he calls God and tells him what he got wrong today and what we're going to do now to fix it. Bull. I don't care who you are. The will of man does not override the will of the Almighty himself and his word in particular. Do not confuse the traditions of man with the commandments of Yah. By doing so, as another famous quote from Scripture says, you make the commandments of Yah of no effect. Who are you to do that? We turn the holy, back to Rabbi Sachs, the source of life itself, into something unholy, and there it becomes a source of death. And he gives some examples. But ultimately, it all goes back to this idea of fire. There's two kinds of fire, too. There's holy fire, there's the set-apart fire that comes from on high, and then there's man attempt to create strange fire, and it goes up to him. And if it's not what he's asked for, it comes back down again. Doesn't work so well. All right, so we've got all of that. Guess what? We're not quite done yet. Because there's more of this parsha, right? And this is the part that people would say, wait a minute, that doesn't make sense. What's that doing in here? Why does he go right from this tragic sequence? And there's a little bit of stuff in between about what happens, of course, with the bodies. They're taken outside the camp. Oh, isn't that interesting? Since we're talking about parallels with Genesis, what happens after the death? Or at least after the act that brings death in both of these stories, in Genesis chapter 3 and, of course, here? The bodies are taken outside the camp. Adam and Eve are put outside the camp. They're put into exile. They're outside the garden. And, of course, you really want to step back and look at the big picture. We're talking about the garden in both of these cases, aren't we? Aren't we talking about a place where man can commune, where Adam literally walked in the garden with God in the cool of the morning? And aren't we talking about the single place in the history of mankind in all of those years since where man gets about as close as he ever did to being able to literally commune with the presence, with the glory of Elohim one more time? Kind of a garden contained within a mishkan, within a world, is how some people have put it. Nadab and Abihu are outside the camp. And they're taken outside the camp completely at this point. Chapter 11. There's some other good stuff in here, but I think we've talked about the gist of it in the bigger picture sense. So on to chapter 11. What part of that fits? By the way, I see a comment on the screen. It's not got the QQQs, but it says, was it out of zeal or out of pride? Well, you know what? Those things can overlap. Those things can be confused, conflated with one another. As a matter of fact, the 80-20 rule, I think, applies. You can still have 100% zeal that's 80% pride, or the other way around, and it can be a problematic situation. If we want to really walk in obedience, we've got to get our zeal aligned with his will, is another way to put it. So back to chapter 11. Why is this part here? Why do all of a sudden we start talking about food, for crying out loud? Well, it's interesting. Last thing in chapter 10 has to do with food, doesn't it? Moses dresses down Aaron. You didn't eat what I told you to eat. Why didn't you do that? Aaron speaks to Moshe, and he says, well, look, behold, this day they've offered their sin offering and their burnt offering before Yahuwah, and I've had a rough day, Moses. Look what these things have befallen me like this. If I had eaten that sin offering today, would it have been well-pleasing in the sight of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? Would that have made the big difference here? When Moshe heard that, it was well-pleasing in his sight. There have been, as you might suspect, multiple explanations offered for that, too. But whatever explanation you prefer, the truth is, Moshe heard it, he was a little bit PO'd, and he says, okay, all right, that's a pretty good explanation, I'll go with that. But it still has to do with food. That's the thing I find that's interesting. Torah has that wonderful connection ability, doesn't it? We're talking about food, and then, bang, here we come right into chapter 11. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh spoke unto Moshe, not just Moshe this time, and to Aaron. And he says to them, you, both of you, speak to the children of Israel. Here are the living things which you may eat among all the beasts that are on the earth. Now, as I go through this, and y'all probably have seen it many, many times, so I'm going to go through it in a different way, because I know everybody knows the criterion. I know in this sense, at least, most people that are trying to walk in obedience to Torah have got this part figured out. They understand the and aspects, the necessary but not sufficient condition stuff that we're talking about here. They know that a four-footed animal, for example, must have both a split hoof, and it must chew the cud. They know the same thing has to do with water creatures, things that swim around in the water, in the rivers, in the seas, in the lakes, in the oceans. They need not only fins, but scales too, or not only scales, but fins too. One or the other is a necessary but not sufficient condition. Gotta have both. Okay. When I go through this, I always point out one more thing that is a real problem for ex-chins, people that have been lied to, because their priests, or at least those that put on the garb of priests and play one on TV, and they pretend they got a phone, they can call up God and tell him what he got wrong. Okay, and yes, if you get the sense here, that I'm not particularly fond of that, because neither, of course, was Yahushua. He said, those that would break even the least of these commandments and teach others to do so, if they repent, and I am convinced that he said it, and they decided later on to drop those couple of words out of the only variance that we still have in existence of that, if they repent, they're still least in the kingdom of heaven. Do not be teaching contrary to the word of God, for crying out loud. And so here we are. We're at a place now where we think food is food, and pig is food. So why can't we eat pig? Answer. You go back and you read the writings of Shaul, or of Peter, or of any of the other folks in the so-called New Testament, the apostolic writings. They never, ever would have conceived that pig would be called food. It was just that simple. They would not call pig meat or food any more than we would call the stuff that the dog left in the backyard meat or food. Ugh, it's not food. But we've been taught all our lives, oh yeah, you take that brown stuff in the backyard, fry it up with a little bit of bacon grease, it's really good. It's not food. So we got a problem with the very words. It's another the primary examples of where we translate certain words from the Hebrew and we don't understand that they don't even map. And it's because of a cultural bias, if you will, that we don't understand. We got a question on the screen from Curtis May about the name of the book that shows that parallel from Genesis 3. Did you put that up there? Okay, so I see it answered. It's an article, and it's actually a video, too. We'll get the link in a second here. Maybe you've got the link. And there was a book, too, that I referenced, and the book was the one that had to do with the parallels from Genesis 3 to Genesis 4. And I'll find the name of the book here in a while, too. What's the core root of eating, even today? Celebrations end in food. That's a good question, and hopefully I will have answered that question by the time we end up here. If I If I haven't, come back to it. Because I'm going to suggest to you that, I'll answer it in brief now. Tell them what you're going to tell them, then tell them what you're going to tell them. Do it, in other words, and then tell them what you told them. So I will suggest to you that if you look in a really, really broad sense and divide the commandments, statutes, and judgments in Scripture into a couple, say, three major categories, it kind of has to do with three major things. The first, in general, has to do with idolatry. Have no other gods before me. There are certainly a whole bunch of separate things that have to do with man's relationship to God, man's relationship to man. But when it comes to some of the things that are prohibited, the other ones we seem to find the most problematic, besides idolatry, in other words, choosing to tell him how he should be worshipped by us, because we know better. Well, the next couple of biggies on the list seem to be sex and food, basic bodily functions. And we'll come back to this last one too about why were pigs created, their purpose. Now this is Markology, and Scripture doesn't tell us why pigs were created. It tells us not to eat them because they're not food, and it tells us how to know. And I'll probably go into a little bit more detail of that, given that there are some of these questions than I was maybe originally planning to. I will suggest that what we now know is that there are some similarities between all of these things that are not food. They're bottom feeders. They're supposed to eat dead stuff. Shrimp and snails and mollusks and starfish and all these other things, scallops, you name it, lobsters, oysters. These lay on the bottom of the ocean and they eat dead stuff and they begin the process of recycling it up the food chain. Turns into vegetable matter, other fish and other things eat that, and they get eaten, and so forth and so on. Eventually you get to something with fins and scale, and you can eat it. It's been kind of cleaned up through a process. Same thing happens on the land. You got functions of things on the land, from worms to pigs, that eat dead stuff and convert them into matter, which can then be turned into vegetables, which can then be eaten by things like cows and deer and goats and sheep with multiple stomachs, and then we can eat them. So the Markology part is me saying what science and other things have said here might be part of the explanation for why it is that the Creator did this. It's a wonderful set of things that he has created to process not food into something that is food. So yeah, pigs and snails are the garbage collectors of the land and the sea, respectively. But that's my take. I think it's a pretty valid take. I can support it with, you know, scientific as well as scriptural background. But I can't support it with Scripture alone, because Scripture just tells us the bottom line. Don't eat them. Okay. And that's a great one. Pigs were created so the Flintstones could have a garbage disposal. Yeah, it pretty much is that simple. All right. Let's talk about the why of this first. This is one of these things that interests me. I started this morning talking about, and we'll come back, we'll get to some of the specifics in a second. Most of you have heard that part, so you're hopefully going to find this more interesting. And for this one, I've got a story that I saw from yet another one of the Midrashim that really resonated. I thought, this is a great story. I got to tell this story, too. And it's an ancient story, evidently, so it's not anything that probably people that were raised in Judaism, at least, haven't heard. But I hadn't heard it before, and I like it. I give it for several reasons. One, because it makes a point I want to make this morning, obviously. And the other one, because we, all of us, deal with Christians. We got family, we got friends, we got people that we know, and they're telling us, why are you not eating pork? This is a great ham sandwich. Chomp down on this. Well, you know what? It's not food. And we get to the point after a few years of walking in obedience where we truly, and I use this analogy that might be offensive to people that have been lied to all their lives about how literally, I don't want to eat a pig sandwich any more than I want to eat a dog poop sandwich. It's not food. It's just not. Oh, but that's offensive, Mark. Well, it's offensive to say that it is food when the Creator of the universe says it's not food. But you know what? People don't understand that. If they've been lied to all their lives and they've been told that dog poop is really good stuff, you'll love it, and they're eating it, or they're eating blood pie, hey, talk to a Brit. they're eating all this stuff that's not food, they're going to have a difficulty with it. It's tough. It's tough for us to say we've inherited lies from our fathers, things where there's no profit, and you know what? It might even be poison in it. Yeah, might be that if you eat this stuff, particularly if we're approaching the end times, that it kills you. We already know, I've mentioned this before, up until genetic engineering anyway, when man learned to mix pig DNA with bird DNA and other things and create new viruses that were even more deadly than anything God had put that so far out there. All right, isn't man smart? We can create things even deadlier than the things we've already created. Well, up until that point at least, every major pandemic in human history came through pigs. Isn't that an amazing fact? Science discovered that not too many years ago. It was part of the, you know, the what I call the two before to the choppers that helped me to realize, hey, just maybe the creator and author of Scripture has a better understanding of how he made us and how he made pigs and how he made the rest of the universe to be than even almighty science in its wisdom knows. Because here's science beginning to discover things that he knew and told all along. So, my point is, when we're talking with ex-chins, or even atheists, and people are saying, why don't you eat pig? I don't care what the Bible says. Well, A, you should, but they're not going to hear that. And B, if they're Christians in particular, they've gotten used to this idea of subtracting from. Remember, the rabbis typically will add to. Here's all these additional things you can't eat. And the Catholics will say, no, you can eat it all. And that goes for the Protestants, too, that essentially are Catholic, whether they know it or not. We're going to eat stuff. We don't care what the creator of the universe says. That's done away with. Well, wait a minute. For those of you that are Christians, I'll start with the process of, you know, how do you approach Christians on this topic? I like to ask them this. On the day that Jesus Christ hung on the cross and died for your sins, did your body change? Okay, maybe your soul changed, or at least the ability for your soul to change. Maybe that was made manifest. Some churches in Christianity teach that. But does any of them teach that all of a sudden, on that particular day, instantly, man's body changed? You know, there were all these changes in his DNA and his endocrine system and his digestive tract, just shebang, they all changed. All of a sudden, you can digest stuff. You got a third stomach, just like cows. But wait a minute, cows aren't supposed to eat pigs either. No, cows eat only veggies, at least the way God designed cows. Oh, we got a problem here. Well, not only that, not only did your body not change, neither did pigs. Pigs, before Jesus, were still the garbage collectors, all the way back to the Flintstones, and they still are. They still are. It's a stupid argument, in other words, that these diseases that were visited upon Israel are no longer visited upon us because now man has refrigeration. Trichinosis. Well, excuse me. There are still things in the pig's bloodstream, still enzymes with names that science still uses, like putrescine and cadaverine. You know what? If you buy a pork loin at the grocery store and you actually had it tested, it's still going to be full of enzymes like putrescine. The root there, if you don't know, is the word putrid, and cadaverine. And the root there is the word cadaver for dead body. These are things that are used to digest dead stuff. And it's still in there. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that appetizing? Isn't that great to know? Maybe that's why it's not food. Okay, so there's part one. For the Christians. In other words, as another friend of mine likes to say, and he was still talking to a lot of Christians too when he provided me with this famous quote that he used many times and I have since pirated. His name's Mike Brown, by the way, so I give credit again where credit's due. Mike likes to say, did Jesus Christ die on the cross so that you could eat a ham sandwich? Even if you're a mainstream Christian, that's trivializing it, don't you think? In other words, you can have a number of different arguments that will make the point. And where I'm going is far beyond that today. Remember, the theme here is necessary but not sufficient conditions. So let's go back to it. Here's the story. A rabbi, says the old story, was once approached by a non-observant Jew. This fellow says he wants to increase his ability to observe Torah. He's trying. He's going to go one step at a time. So he's willing to add one and only one new mitzvah to his repertoire. And he asks his rabbi, okay, here's the deal. I am going to observe either, but not both, either the laws of Shabbat or the laws of Kashrut. Take your pick, rabbi. Tell me what you ought to do. Keep Sabbath or keep kosher? Well, of course, goes without saying, says everybody, yet you should observe all of the things that the creator of the universe says you should do. Don't pick and choose. But here the rabbi realizes, look, this guy's serious. He ain't going to listen to me if I tell him that any more than some Christian's going to listen to you, right? So what do you do instead? So he went to another great Torah sage to ask the question, who replied that he should take on the laws of Kashrut. He should learn what's food and what's not food, and he should eat food and avoid non-food. Now, that is quite surprising, say many, because the punishment for breaking the Shabbat is far more severe than for simply eating not food. And I'm going to pause with that, and I'll say, ultimately, the penalty may very well be death anyway. So I'm not sure if I buy that. But we're telling the story here, so I'm going to go back to the story. The sage explains, though, that there's a deeper factor at work. Now, when I see this, my eyes kind of perk up, and I say, oh, this is interesting. Tell me more. When a person eats non-kosher food, says the sage, he eats food that is not food. That's the real way to put it. Not only does he transgress the instruction of Torah, but he brings himself into something which they call timtum halev, spiritual impurity, because of some things that's contained in the food, the dirtiness, if you will, of the food. On a practical level, they say this means that a person's spiritual sensitivities are dulled when they eat not food, when they break the commandment. And interestingly, that word timtum halev literally is translated as a blockage of the heart. Now, I think that's particularly interesting because sometimes that's what happens. Literally, it's a blockage of the heart, and they die. And their heart might get blocked for a number of reasons. Maybe they get diseases. You know, you can go back and look at history and realize that in the time of the Dark Ages and the Black Plague, a part of the reason why Jews were persecuted is because they weren't dying like a lot of the people. They weren't eating mice and pigs. And they weren't, therefore, dying of the things that were these diseases that were associated with those things. Well, back to the spiritualization here. If this timtum halev happens, people's spiritual sensitivities are dulled by their eating of non-meats or non-food foods, non-kosher foods, and therefore, that makes it difficult for the person to increase their spiritual level even further. So you'll find this theme that kind of runs through a lot of rabbinic Judaism. You begin to walk in obedience, you can increase your spiritual level. And you've seen that. I've seen teachings that talk about how the people come out of Mitzrayim, out of Egypt, and their spiritual level increases. 42 levels even of spiritual level increase. Okay? And whether you believe all of that or not is not as important, and a lot of the Christians aren't going to hear that part. But I think they are going to hear the bottom line at this point. So, the sage says when the bottom line gets met, it is this man who's not willing to take but one step at a time should first follow the laws of Kashrut. Learn what is food and eat that. With the hope that that would facilitate the unblocking of his heart and ultimately enable him to increase his observance still further. Okay, time out. Y'all have heard the story about Acts 15, right? Here are the four minimum conditions, the necessary but not sufficient conditions to come into the synagogues on the Shabbat, right? Did they not say Moses is taught in every synagogue in every city throughout the land? Get them cleaned up enough to come in the door. The minimum but not sufficient, the necessary but not sufficient condition, they can learn the rest. If people aren't clean enough to get in the door, how are they going to learn the rest of it? So that's part A. Again, this is the explanation for the people that won't do it at all. And it's interesting to me that a lot of people come to Sabbath first among the so-called Hebraic Roots movement or the first century Christian movement or the Messianic movement, whatever you want to call it, Torah observant believers. Well, how do we get Torah observant? One step at a time. Sometimes it's Shabbat first. That's a lot of the common ones. In my case, I'll admit it, it was pigs first because I could see the physical reasoning in that one. So to me, that resonates for that reason as well. But there's one more thing here. I'm going to summarize the bottom line a little different way than the rabbi did, but I think maybe this will resonate with some Christians and some atheists too. Let me put it this way, folks. It's tough to be set apart when you're poisoned. You can't very well keep Sabbath if you're dead. And they've seen that if they don't keep Sabbath, they don't die immediately. And they've even seen that if they eat pork, they don't die immediately. But what I'm going to suggest is the times we're entering into, they're both going to be important. We're talking about necessary but not sufficient conditions, and there's more than one of them. If people won't do any of them, they're dead anyway. But we got to get them started somehow. Now, back to this particular Torah portion, because I think it's interesting. By the way, I've already mentioned sex and food. We've seen a lot of emphasis on sexuality. Saw a story this week that the increase in various types of gonorrhea that are antibacterial resistant, antibiotic resistant, is now approached a level where science and medicine is very concerned. We're getting to, you know, within spitting distance of a virulent variety of gonorrhea that cannot be cured by any antibacterial agent known to man, period. People catch this one, they're dead. Or they're going to suffer with it for a long, long time and then die. It's pretty nasty. Isn't it interesting? We're seeing a place where, I will contend, and we'll talk about the news in a minute, we're seeing more and more of these things that are going to literally be matters of life and death. We're going to have to learn to walk in obedience or not. Let me cut to the chase. We'll come back, fill in the gaps, but I want to get to the chase here because this is kind of where we're at. Turn to the end of chapter 11 and read what it says there. See if this doesn't resonate with this whole theme of the portion, because this is the way the parsha ends. It tells about all these swarming things, things that go about on their bellies. You don't eat those things either. They are detestable. Don't eat snakes. Don't eat centipedes or millipedes or a lot of other stuff. Dare not to make yourselves unclean with them, that you could be defiled thereby. For, why? Why is this important? For ani Yahuwah Elohechem. I am Yahuwah your God. I am the Lord your God, says the King James. For I am ki ani Yahuwah Elohechem. So set yourselves apart, therefore, and you be holy, be kadosh, because I am holy. I am set apart, kadosh. Nor are you to defile yourselves with any manner of swarming thing that moves upon the earth, for I, ani Yahuwah, I am the Elohim that brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your Elohim. Therefore, you shall be holy. He says it twice. He must think it's important. Therefore, be holy, be kadosh, be set apart, for I am kadosh. And then he says, this is the instruction of the beast, of the fowl, and of every living creature that moves in the waters or that swarms upon the earth. Why? Ah, here it comes again. Now, this theme just kind of comes all the way through this portion, doesn't it? To make a difference. To set apart. The tameh and the tahor, the unclean and the clean. And between the living thing that is food, that may be eaten, and the living thing that is not food, may not be eaten. He puts this in here, I will suggest. He puts it in here because he wrote it. He can put it wherever he wants. Okay? That's the real simple answer. But he put it in here, I think, because it fits perfectly. Because he's just finished talking about how it was all these folks did as commanded. Moshe and Aaron, they did what they were commanded to do. Positive commands. Do this. Yes, sir. And they did it. There are also negative commands. Do not do this. No, sir. Won't do that. And then you know what? There are additions and subtractions. There are places where the Torah is silent and where he expects us to say, look, you ought to know that. I've heard many, many, many parents, probably had it said to myself, how old are you now, son? Are you 16? Are you 18? Are you 12? Don't you know better than that? Do I have to tell you? Don't do that? Oh, for crying out loud, I can't believe you did something that stupid. Are you a priest? Are you expecting to be a priest? Are you claiming to be a priest? Do you play one on TV? Then for crying out loud, don't be adding to and subtracting from. You ought to know that. So, we got positive commands, we got negative commands, and we've got these other things where if you're going to be a priest and you expect to walk literally into the presence of the Almighty, know to do it the way he says. And furthermore, here we get to the end of the story. If you're going to be a priest, learn to set apart the tahor and the tameh. Learn what is holy and what is not holy, and teach that. And for crying out loud, don't teach the opposite of that and then still call yourself a priest. You're not fit to stand in my presence. You got to know better. for the rest of us. For the rest of us who, well, A, recognize that there are priests that are putting on the garments, or at least some garments. You know, they remind me a little bit of the tin plate dictator that's got all the medals and badges on. Looks very impressive. He's a liar and the truth is not in him in so many cases. Well, so once we begin to realize that, we say, okay, I'm beginning to understand false teachers. I can read Deuteronomy 13. I know what a false prophet is, too. I know that if they're telling me to do something that he did not command, or if they're telling me something that is contradictory to the written word of Yod, Heh, Vav, Heh, they ain't serving him. Don't do that. Now what? Okay. I can see that he never did away with telling us that such and such is now food, and it's not. And if you find something in a translation of the New Testament that says, thus he made all foods clean, scratch it out or throw the stinking book from the pit of you-know-where away, because it's a lie. He did not say that. Well, I guess you could be real, real lawyerly and say, yes, he did say all foods were clean. But you know what? He didn't say that pig was ever food. Oh, it kind of depends on what the meaning of the word food is, doesn't it? So many ways to lie and cheat and steal with words. It all depends on what the meaning of the word is too. Back to the summary here. Again, for the people that are coming out, for the times that we're entering, we're going to talk about this again at the news as we're fixing to go into it. Try to get people to start with the minimum necessary conditions. If you know, if this is a family member, a loved one, a coworker, a friend, somebody that you know reasonably well. Well, you know, in your case, maybe it is. You know that it'll be easier for him to keep Shabbat than it would be to keep away from bacon. Or vice versa. I mean, I've certainly heard a perfectly good excuse. Well, you know, my job requires me to work on Saturday. I can't keep Sabbath. Well, don't tell me you can't. Because the creator of the universe says you can. And if you're willing to be obedient, trust me, he'll make a way. In that case, maybe it's easier for you to say, okay, I will not eat pig. I'll give up my scallops, too. Fine. Just start. Walk it out. And by the way, remember, if you're dead, you can't do either. If you're poisoned because of what's coming in the world, and by the way, there's a whole lot of poisons out there. We've spent the last few months at this point talking about some of them. Got a new one this week. Franken vanilla, if you haven't heard about that one. More poisons being introduced. Hey, Jesus says we can tread on serpents and scorpions and eat poisons and it won't hurt us. Maybe so. But if you're not walking into obedience first, you know, as my dad used to say, if you fall and break both your legs, don't come running to me. In other words, if you're not walking in obedience, for crying out loud, why would you expect to be able to eat poison and get away with it? I already told you don't eat poison. Don't you know better? Okay, questions, comments? Let me take a quick peek. Did I miss any other questions? I hope we got to the ones about pigs or creation, the core root of eating and celebrations and food. I don't know that I answered that one completely. This is Markology, because I don't know that Scripture tells us explicitly without connecting dots. But I will say it this way. There's a couple of Midrashim in Scripture that point this out. He has all things worked out for our good, if we're called according to His purposes. And as a friend of mine likes to say, you know, a lot of times in Scripture, the Creator of the universe says, hey, come on now, let's have a barbecue. It really is. He wants to be joyful with us. He wants to walk in the garden in the morning, and He wants us to enjoy a great barbecue. He likes to smell that savor that we ought to like to smell, too. These things are not burdensome. I find personally, the more I have walked through it, I think this is true for many of you. We had a nice celebration at Sukkot last year. Looking forward to it again this year. Looking forward to Pesach. These are things that, yes, they're commanded. And you know what? If we'll walk them in obedience, they're joyful too. These are very joyful things, wonderful stuff. You know what? Okay, here we get politically incorrect. Sex is joyful too. Eating a little bit of great food, having a barbecue, drinking some wonderful wine. I had to learn to like wine. I grew up not liking wine. I just didn't like the taste of it. I don't still like all wines, but I found that there are some that are pretty wonderful. I'm beginning to suspect that I know what the Creator was talking about when He says, this is a good wine. You know, enjoy this. I made this. People have made it for you. These hands have been blessed. This is for your blessing and for your joy. Do it. Do it and like it. Even do it remembering me. I got no problem with that. Can sex be joyful? Can it be the kind of communion that points us to the eventual? Yeah, politically incorrect, but this is really at the heart of Judaism, even Kabbalah, if you understand it. This kind of joyful union that we can have with the Creator, this thing we do not want to be cut off from, probably the closest we can get to it in an earthly form, is the kind of covenant relationship, one flesh, that comes from that very human, very intimate relationship. It's a beautiful and it's a wonderful thing. So, to some extent, it does not surprise me that all of these three things that I pointed out earlier should go together. Idolatry, why? Because like adultery, it stands in the way of this ultimate communion, this ultimate covenant between us and Him. And it represents something we can relate to on the one hand that's so horribly negative, and it shows us as close as we can wrap our heads around to how He's feeling about certain things. So you got idolatry and adultery on the one hand, then you got the other two that we just tend to have problems with, food and sex. And both of them can be both the greatest blessings and they can carry the greatest curses, including disease ending in death if we're not careful. If we're not walking in obedience. So really it is ultimately kind of sort of that simple. And yet also there's that much other detail in it. All right, I don't see any other questions. By the way, usual reminder, I cannot get into the talking Torah room while I'm online here because I get kicked off too regularly. So if there's somebody over there that wants to pass along, if there were any questions, pop those up. Okay, I think we've already got most of them. So if we haven't, that's okay. Still talking about minimum necessary conditions. Minimum meaning necessary but not sufficient, right? I said I would talk a little bit more about the pig thing and the shellfish thing. About the only thing I didn't mention on that score is another interesting one. I did talk about this last night. There's a lot made in Judaism about the fact that the swine, the pig, the boar, that the family of animals, that kind of thing, that kind of swine is the only animal of its type. Bible gives this example. It says, all right, look, understand this. It is a necessary but not sufficient condition that the animal part the hoof. It's cloven-footed, in other words. And, here comes the and part, it must also chew the cud. If it has both and only both of these things, you may eat it. It is food for you. But if it's just one but not the other, it's not food. So to make this very clear, because Scripture is nothing if not clear, when it is really a matter of life and death and the Creator wants you to know, hey, here's the owner's manual, right? I'm maybe trivializing it, maybe not, because sometimes we have to kind of hear it in these terms to get it through our heads. You did not put sugar in your gas tank. You might like the sugar. Your car will not. Car was not designed to eat sugar. You are not designed to eat pig. Do you see the connection? Read the owner's manual in both cases, and it'll tell you what's food for your car is not food for you, and what's food for you and vice versa is not true. This is not food. Sugar's not food for your car. Pig is not food for you. But it gives us first examples of other things, like camels and rock badgers and bunnies and hares and rabbits that are not food. They may chew the cud, but they don't have a parted hoof. Now we come to the one example, and this is the thing. It only gives one example in Scripture, and the sages and the biologists will tell us that there's only one example. The swine is the only animal that has a parted hoof. In other words, he's cloven-footed, but does not chew the cud. Now I've heard it explained this way, and I like this. This is why I'm spending an extra couple minutes, and it fits where we're going next. It fits that you have to watch. You have to watch this animal. You got to know something about this animal. You can't just come upon one for the first time in the woods and say, Shazam, never saw that thing with that flat nose before. I wonder what that is. Oh, it's got a cloven hoof. I bet I can eat it. No, you better watch him for a minute and you'll see. He does not chew the cud. He is deceptive. On first glance, you'd swear. He looks like food. Eat him. But he's not. And again, he is the only, he being the swine, the family of all kinds of piggies and boars and swines, the only animal of its kind that is not food. So he's deceptive. And so the rabbis will say, he not only is deceptive, by the way, I will I will suggest to you, too, look at the common usage of the word. You'll see that they're not alone in drawing this conclusion. If you want to call somebody the worst animal you can think of, what do you call them? A pig! You're a swine, man! It's a purgative in almost, it's a purgative in every language on earth that I've ever heard. You pick a language, Russian, Spanish, you're a puerco. You're a chonko. They got several different terms in Spanish just to demean somebody by calling them a pig. People know there's something unclean about this thing. But you do have to watch. You do have to know. The pig is deceptive. And when people are particularly deceptive, you know, the used car salesman, he's a pig. He's trying to sell you a pig in a poke. How many times, how many ways do we find the language reflects the truth of Scripture, even if the church lies about it? I think it's funny. All right, that brings me smoothly, I hope, to the news for today, and I'm going to start with this one. I'm going to call these first couple of stories admissions. You knew this was true all along. Oh, yeah, I see that on the screen. I'm going to go there just quickly for a second. There's all kinds of things. The more you learn about pigs and their biology, the more you realize they're unclean in so many ways. Pigs don't sweat. Yes, all of the stuff that an animal that sweats would sweat out through its skin, all those little wonderful poisons that other animals sweat out like humans, right? Would you want to eat armpit juice? Probably not. Well, in the case of pigs, if you like bacon, you are. Because all of that stuff that gets sweated out through people's armpits, in the case of pigs, which are biologically fairly similar to man, ends up right in the bacon. Mmm, good. Okay, not only that, here's the worst of them. I've already mentioned the trichinosis. Forget trichinosis and refrigeration. That's the least of it, folks. Ask any pig farmer about the little tube that runs down the pig's body. You can't see me demonstrating this, but runs down the inside of the pig's arms and legs, right? His 4 feet. The little tube that runs down there. This is an effluent spigot. And for lack of a better word, pus flows down this little spigot and flows out the pig's hoof area. And any good vet will tell you if that pus pocket gets plugged up, the pig will die. It'll literally choke on its own effluent. And so I've heard, I told this story one time years ago in Torah teaching to a bunch of old farm women. I mean, the average age of these women that were listening that day, I don't remember where I was speaking, but they were probably all in their 60s and 70s. And all these women, and they're laughing and chuckling and hitting each other out in the audience. One of them comes up to me afterwards, she says, "Mark, we were all raised on a farm." We knew all of that long before you heard about it. I said, "Well, that's good." She says, "Everybody that's ever raised pigs knows that if those little pus vents get plugged up," she had another name for them, I don't know what they called them, "that pig is going to die." So the vet comes out, unplugs them, and out it comes. Oh, man. Not food. Let me say it again, folks. Not food. All right. Talking about dishonesty and admissions of dishonesty. And the pig will hide it, and so will so many of the pigs in government and in the public-private piggy partnership, the PPPP that we have out there. I don't know what order to do these in. Let's go this way with it. Busted, says a piece earlier in the week. This is from Tyler Durden in Zero Hedge. The U.S. tech giants, he's talking about Microsoft, he's talking about Apple, he's talking about the phone manufacturers, he's talking about the telecom companies, the Verizons and the Quests. They knew about the NSA spying. They've been lying and lying and lying, and now it comes out. Michael Krieger wrote it this way. This is why I've been so confused and frustrated by the repeated reports of behavior of the U.S. government. Who's he quoting? The Facebook CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, in a post on Facebook last week. Now get this, folks. This pig said he was confused and frustrated by the reports about the behavior of the U.S. government. Well, I just can't imagine what was going on. He says, "Our engineers work tirelessly to improve security, and we imagine we are protecting you against criminals, not our own government. Why, I even called President Barack Obama personally to express my frustration." I don't know why I'm doing the piggy raising voice, but it fits here. "Over the damage the government has created for our future, but we're going to take a while before we get to reform." So Zuckerberg made headlines when he posted that line of tripe. about how he called the president to express his outrage and shock about the government's spying activities. Of course, says Michael Krieger, anybody who is familiar with Facebook and what's going on already knows that between these private tech behemoths and the U.S. intelligence agency, his statement was one gigantic pile of stinking pig poop. Yeah, now we have the proof. He said something that was even a little bit worse, but I cleaned it up a bit, but I still wanted you to get the gist of it. Earlier today, he notes, the senior lawyer for no such agency, no, they've admitted that they exist now, the National Stasi Agency, made it completely clear that U.S. tech companies were fully aware of all the spying going on, including the prison program. So, says Michael Krieger, stop acting, all of you Silicon Valley CEOs. We know you were fully on board with extraordinary violations of your fellow citizens' rights and liberties. You've known it all along. Stop BSing us. You've done enough harm. The Guardian basically had the full story. This is the same folks that brought you the Ed Snowden revelations. Turns out that the general counsel of the National Security Agency stated unequivocally on Wednesday that U.S. tech companies were fully aware of their partnership with Big Brother. He said all communications content and associated metadata harvested by NSA in violation of the Constitution, but in accord with an unconstitutional act in 2008, did so with the full knowledge of those companies, both when it comes to internet collection and the prison program, and for the so-called upstream collection of communications across the web. The pigs were lying. The pigs were deceptive. Don't eat those pigs, by the way. How much does Microsoft charge for the data that it, the piglet there, provides to the FBI? Not just the NSA, but FBI. This comes from Gizmodo, and it turns out it also comes, you ready for this, from the Syrian Electronic Army, which hacked into the FBI's super secret DITU, that stands for Digital Intercept Technology Unit. They, too, are in cahoots, the pigs, with the other pigs in the public-private piggy partnership, and they are all tapping and stealing and lying, and they're going to tell you, hey, you signed the data. We lied to you about it, but it's in the fine print there. You just didn't read carefully enough, you little deceived piglet, you. I guess this. It turns out that what the Syrian Electronic Army did was they revealed the receipts, the invoices from Microsoft to the FBI. Microsoft had been getting $100 each and every time that the NSA bugged somebody, or the FBI in this case, bugged somebody unlawfully and in violation of their oath. We don't need a stinking warrant. We got a deal. Cost them $100. But in August 2013, last year, Microsoft doubled the charges. Now they get $200 for a request, and they got $350,000-some-odd. This is per month, folks, per month. And then the most recent invoice from November, they have upped the price again. Now, what do they charge for Windows 7 or Windows 8? You know, it's $100, a couple hundred bucks for one of these pieces of spying propaganda. Microsoft gets more each and every time they use the back doors that they built in for these unconstitutional pig agencies than they get for selling this not even waterproof, this piece of trash operating system to you, telling you how secure it is and how secure Facebook is, according to Zuckerberg. Their engineers are working so hard to lie to you about what they're doing to you. Now, here's my comment. It's not even apropos to call what your computer is doing to spy on you a back door anymore, right? That's what we call these things, a back door. NSA has a back door into your Windows operating system. No! They told you what it was when they sold it to you. It's a window, man! Windows! Guess what they're looking at in the windows? The peeping piggy toms are peeping through your windows. The pigs? I've always wondered, why they call it Windows? Well, now we know. Because it's a door. It's a window. No, it's looking right in your bedroom. It's looking into your life, for crying out loud. But the admissions are there. They've been lying to you for so long, but now they got all this stuff in place. The pigs are coming right out and admitting it. Now, that's not enough. Here's two more. This is how we're starting the news this week. With Bernanke gone, Helicopter Ben himself. This is another piece from Zero Hedge. The remaining Fed members know well that they will be crucified, metaphorically, of course, when it all inevitably comes crashing down. We're going to talk about the latest lies from Janet Reno. No, Janet Yellen. Hard to keep the pigs in the right parlor. Anyway, the truth is now bleeding out, a little bit at a time, courtesy of the president of the Dallas Fed, a fellow named Fisher, who says, get this, that QE was a massive gift intended to boost wealth. Guess whose? The other pigs, of course. And what's funny, says Zero Hedge, is this coincides with Bernanke's heartfelt admission not long ago that, quote, my natural inclinations, says the former pig in charge of the Federal Reserve, that even if it weren't for the legal mandate, we would be to try and would be to try to help the average person, unquote. Well, you know, as Zero Hedge says, as long as it helps to boost the wealth of the average non-billionaire, well, all is forgiven. Of course, you can be millionaires and billionaires. Anyway, the result, says Bernanke, was that there are still many people after the crisis who still feel that it was unfair, that some companies got helped, and the small banks and small businesses and average families didn't get direct help. No, the only ones that got help, folks, were the too big to fail and too big to jail. Or I guess we could today, in keeping with the theme, say the too big to fail, no, the too pig to fail, and the too pig to jail. Bernanke said, it's a tough perception to break. The truth, now being again revealed by Dallas Fed President Fisher, will not help in breaking that perception either. You want to find the pigs? Follow the money, right? Here we go. This is the big financial story of the week. Of course, the Fed's Open Market Committee, Pig Central, met this week. And they basically, they kept up the lie, and there were a couple more admissions that sneaked out. Now, this one's funny. Unlike the Fed president in Dallas, you have to read carefully. But fortunately, we got some pretty good analysts that are reading carefully. If you want to interpret the new Fed chairman's remarks, she prefers to be called a chairman. I'll just simply leave it at that. And we'll go first to the Telegraph, which played it straight. Telegraph out of London. They said, America is not expected to raise interest rates until next year. After U.S. Federal Reserve Chairperson Janet Yellen said the central bank would stop. Stop lying? No. They're going to stop telling you the old story. Used to be, remember, they said 6.5% unemployment, that is the target. Unless we change our mind. Why are they changing their mind? Because they've been lying, they've been caught, and they need to make it clear, because they're going to telegraph their moves, that we are capricious and arbitrary. So she set out a potential timetable for the change. And that's where she got into trouble, because it seemed to scare the markets to you-know-what. In her first press conference as chairman, the Fed's Open Market Committee instead promised to assure and assess progress towards its objectives of maximum employment. See, they dropped that 6.5% thing, and a 2% inflation rate. They're really excited about the 2% inflation. Of course, they're lying about how much we've already got and telling us that it's non-existent. That ain't true. The Wall Street Journal revealed this week, for example, that meat inflation, beef price inflation, surged in the month of February, the most in a decade. As food inflation soars, beef prices up again 5% in the month of February alone. Prices are also higher, not just for beef, but for other things. Fruits, veggies, sugar, and beverages, according to the official government numbers. But remember, they tell you that that doesn't matter. If something is increasing in price, they just take it out of the index and say, except for food and energy, which are, you know, literally priced to the point where the average American can't afford them anyway, unless they're a well-connected pig, well, you're in trouble. Coffee prices have surged more than 70% this year. Hogs are up 42% because, I like this, it's funny anyway, I don't like it. Hogs are up 42% because of disease concerns. Talked about that last week. Cocoa's up 12%. So food prices are up, but not inflation. Back to Janet Yellen and the other lies. The Fed is expected to end its bond buying scheme. This is even the London Telegraph calls it a scheme. In autumn, as long as the economy improves, suggesting that an interest rate rise would come no sooner than spring 2015. Hey, folks, no sooner than spring 2015. Ain't that far away. Remember, necessary but not sufficient conditions. When's the earliest it could come? Spring 2015. That scared folks, because then they started thinking it might really be spring 2015. Earlier, she'd said that it would be in a considerable time after they wrapped up their bond-buying scheme. So somebody asked her, well, what does considerable time mean? 5 years? 7 years? 2 years? No, she said, 6 months. And there was a collective intake of breath around the table, and the market promptly sold off 200 points. But later on, you know, they were receiving the assurances. Not to worry, little piggies, the ride to the rendering plant or whatever, you know, it's going to be fine. We're going to dope you up first, give you some great money printing to keep you happy. Okay, I'm going to skip the rest of this stuff. There was one or two funny lines towards the end of the story here from the even from the Telegraph. Now, basically, the Telegraph was towing the party line. They're not telling you the straight piggy, if you will. But she does say two things. I mentioned one of them already, that the Federal Reserve, quote, probably overdid the optimism when they've been talking about how good the economy is for however long they've been talking about it. They probably overdid the optimism. And furthermore, the Fed's officials, including Yellen, are still blaming the weather for the recent weak economic data. Now, I got a whole stack of stories here from the folks that I would call the good analysts, very briefly, about the recent Fed Reserve, FOMC policy statement. And maybe we'll just do this one. This is from Peter Schiff. And Schiff is a well-known Austrian economist. And by the way, I would put myself in that camp as well as being a biblical economist. And I'll contend to you that if you compare the Bible with the Austrian theory, you'll find out right down the line, pretty solid. Basically, it says if you print money that like there's no tomorrow, in other words, if you enter into abomination that is not supposed to be done, it will bring curses. I guess that's a pretty simple way to say it. Here's how Peter Schiff says it, though, with regard to Janet. Janet Yellen's task on Wednesday was to move the Fed's goalpost without anyone realizing why she's doing it. That the economy is weaker than they've been lying about. Her success on that front has largely been made possible by Wall Street cheerleaders and a docile and compliant media. Main problem the Fed has been facing over the past few months is that the official unemployment rate, which they lie about, of course, and manipulate the figures. What they do is they just tell everybody, once you get disgusted, we're going to drop you off the register anyway. You don't count. When you can't find a job and you give up, well, we pretend you went away. And you know what they say? Well, the last person out the door shut off the lights. If everybody loses their job and everybody quits looking for a job, guess what, folks? The unemployment rate goes to zero. Yay! We got full employment. Everybody that still thinks there's a job has one. There just aren't any of them. This is the fallacy here, right? This number will go to zero regardless of how bad the actual employment situation is. So there's the lie. So the problem is the official unemployment rate has been steadily drifting downward as they lie about the other figures and manipulate the data. So now they got a problem. The rate has been falling, as Schiff says, not because people are getting jobs, but because they've stopped looking for them. So as a result, the Fed has had to change their own rules and change their prior guidance. So today's statement from the FOMC completely dropped any reference to their former magic number, that 6.5% threshold. However, this is where Peter Schiff nails it. However, had the Fed acknowledged the real reasons behind that move, investor confidence would have been, and I think this is putting it delicately, severely shaken. When you have an economy based on illusion, he said, uttering truth can be really dangerous. So what we have is that Yellen followed the script on QE tapering. Everybody knew and expected they were going to taper another $10 billion fiat fake dollars. Big deal. But she can abandon that commitment just as easily, the commitment to wind it down to zero, just as easily as she walked away from the Fed's commitment to raise rates once unemployment hit their magic number of 6.5%. What we're going to see, he suggests, is there'll be other excuses that will come up. Surprise, surprise. Michael Pinto says, of course, the Fed lowered their monthly purchases. Everybody knew that. It's already in the cards. Didn't surprise anybody. And they also eliminated their numerical threshold. reason for that, of course, is obvious. The Fed simply cannot raise rates, even though they scared the market and launched their trial balloon by saying that they would think about it 6 months or so after they hit their targets. Trouble is, of course, that's never going to happen because they're never going to hit their targets. They're never going to get to the necessary condition, which is an improving economy, which ain't going to happen. For the same reason that the person that's drinking poison doesn't get better. Interest rates, eventually, he says, are going to rise sharply. Why? Because nobody wants U.S. Treasury debt. We'll talk about another reason in just a couple minutes here. And the other reason may be coming sooner rather than later. And part of that connects with part of the other reasons why there's so much lying going on and so many admissions if you learn to recognize the pigs and see that they're not chewing the cud. Deteriorating and anemic data will continue, and they'll continue to worsen as interest rates rise. Eventually, interest rates will rise sharply. That's deflationary in the short term. That's why the dollar went up. It's bullish for the dollar in the short term, but it won't last. That means the Fed will stop tapering sometime in the very near future, probably at the same time they're saying that they're going to be done anyway. It's just that they're not going to be done because they went to zero. They're going to be done for other reasons. They're lying about that. It'll happen in the summer or early fall, he says. Then they will reverse QE, and when that policy shift takes place, it will be very significant. This is Michael Pinto for World Markets, beyond anything we have seen before. He's not alone in that. By the way, he says the other thing you'll notice here is they're trying to sell this 2% inflation. Oh, inflation's not high enough. Oh, it's so low. Oh, we're so scared of deflation. Got to find a way to get more inflation. Don't worry, folks. They've got a way. And you're already seeing it if you realize they're lying. They're trying to convince people that higher inflation is a good thing. Well, tell people who've been to the grocery store that higher inflation is a good thing. By the way, inflation can be had, and it can be exported, too. What we're seeing is it's the emerging economies of the world that are feeling the bite first. If you think it's bad in U.S. supermarkets for milk and for beef, look and see what it costs overseas just about anywhere in the so-called third world countries, the emerging markets. They're really taking it on the chin. By the way, I'll add one more commentary in here. This is kind of like the third witness, Gerald Celente. He's essentially said almost the same thing down the line. Fed is going to continue to print money. It's only going to get worse. They're going to reverse QE. All that's fine. But he does say this. This is where I like Celente's comments. At some point, the Fed's going to have to put more stimulus in. They all agree on that. They're going to have to juice the economy because the economy can't sustain itself. Now, get this. Here's the part that he adds to the mix. The economy couldn't even sustain itself when they were printing $85 billion a month in so-called stimulus. It's still tanking. What did Janet Yellen say? Perhaps we overdid the optimism. No, you lied, and you knew it. They couldn't even sustain the economy with $85 billion of newly printed money. It's not going to sustain itself with less. It couldn't sustain itself with interest rates at historic record lows. Interest rates are as low as they can go, and it ain't happening. So he says, you're going to see the equity markets respond violently, particularly in those emerging markets, real soon now. So they will reverse themselves, and they'll do like what they did in Japan. In Japan, the money printing was called Abenomics. And he thinks that when it's tried in America, they can't say QE anymore, and they just can't come right out and call it money printing. So maybe they'll call it Yellenomics, and it'll be a failure as well. The Fed has no way out. Okay, remember those lines. That's where I want to come back to. The Fed has no way out. So, you know the old story, if there's no way out, you better blow a door somewhere. You got to find another way out. Ah, maybe this is it. Maybe we saw it with the war, right? Maybe we saw it with what's happening in the sanctions battles between the U.S. and Russia. I'll just throw that out for a second. We're going to come back to it in a minute. But first, I want to point out another nail in the coffin, I guess you will. This is China, bursting of China's credit bubble. And we've talked about this for the last several weeks. China's credit bubble is on the edge, says a piece from the Silver Doctors this week. Alistair MacLeod, I got a couple of comments from him in a couple different forums. one of them I started with, I think. Maybe I didn't mention it. We'll come back to his second one in just a minute. anyway, in this particular case, he points out that China is in a world of hurt. And China has more money printing that they've already done, more quantitative easing and what's called their shadow banking system than even America. You think we've been printing money? The Chinese learned it from the best. They've been printing money even more. They got whole cities, concrete poured, that nobody's living in. And now they're finding that things are beginning to collapse. This week, here's a story about the largest steelmaker in the Shanxi province just got defaulted on a 3 billion yuan debt note. It's the second or third in recent days. There was another one we talked about last week. A big solar manufacturer defaulted on their debt. They're going bankrupt. They're going belly up. The Chinese government is not bailing out the too big to fail like the United States government is. They got more chutzpah, at least, than Big Brother Bankster does. He only lets the too small to bother with fail. But the Goldman Sachs and the J.P. Morgans, well, they get bailed out. As the story from Zero Hedge said, they're dropping like flies now. Here's another story. This is from Morgan Stanley. And they've come out and said that Minsky moment is here in China. Basically, the Minsky moment is the time when the Ponzi scheme, that is the Ponzi finance, the debt without limit, goes up. And here's how this one begins. This is Morgan Stanley basically writing this. We've described in detail, says Morgan Stanley's folks, over the past couple of years how we believe China's twin excesses, excessive investment funded by excessive debt, will inevitably unwind. Even the big guys are admitting this. And in recent weeks, they made a trip, and a further research into China's shadow banking system has convinced us that China is now approaching the Minsky moment, where a disorderly unwind of their debt structure could take Chinese growth down from the stellar numbers that it's had to 4% in a very short time frame, with potentially disastrous consequences for levered Chinese assets, banks and property and so forth. So basically what they're saying is, look, China's beginning to collapse. This is the world's hope for growth. Okay, we'll get to the question in just a second. I was just looking back up and seeing that and noting, yeah, this will fit. So hopefully I'll answer it in just about 10 seconds. But meanwhile, China is looking literally like it's collapsing. Here's one more story that makes that point just this week, too. From the housing market, the music just ended, says a piece from Zero Hedge. Wealthy Chinese, remember how they were buying up all of these luxury penthouses in New York and luxury ocean view homes in Los Angeles and San Diego and in San Francisco? Well, now wealthy Chinese are liquidating those very same offshore luxury homes in a mad scramble for cash. Now, their real estate bubble, and in this case it's a bubble that was in the United States, and the high end is collapsing as well. So we're seeing all of these things. I'm going to go somewhere else slightly different in just a second, because I'm going to suggest to you that when this stuff begins to come apart in China, you're going to see some other things that will kind of tip off the situation to be indicators. But the question, will the dollar hyperinflate before it falls? And the answer is, I'm not sure, but if I had to bet, I'll bet you it's the other way around. Okay, well, and that's what we're seeing right now. We're seeing the dollar actually appreciate. This week they hammered gold and hammered other currencies around the world. Why? Well, because the Fed is jawboning. The Fed is lying. The Fed is saying that, oh, we may have to raise rates sooner rather than later. And by the way, they may lose this gamble. They launched a trial balloon to see if they could scare the markets into thinking that they're actually going to raise rates. So they scared the market into thinking, oh, the dollar may be more valuable than we think because interest rates will go up. And if they do this stuff, well, then gold will go down. The dollar looks really, really good. We will be sucked back into the dollar. So what I'm suggesting is that what will happen is the opposite, probably. The dollar will look stronger than it really is, and then when the wheels come off the wagon, then they begin the money printing. They'll export the inflation first to those emerging markets. In other words, they'll make the other emerging markets, the Brazils and the Indonesias and the other places around the world, bear the initial brunt of the inflation. And as long as those dollars are being exported, right, Nobody in America knows. They're not seeing the dollar showing up at their grocery stores. They think it's all fine for a while, until the chickens come home to roost. Then you see the hyperinflation, and then comes the end. So is it ending in fire or ice or both? Well, if I really had to bet, and here's the way I think it really will boil down, folks, you're going to see both. You're going to see dollar inflation and dollar deflation. And it'll probably break along these lines. How things that people buy with debt, think houses and cars, right? Things people buy with debt will be the ones where we see a deflationary spiral, because the debt gets defaulted on. Things that people need to live and that they essentially buy with cash, right? Food, oil, energy, electricity, gas, water, all of those things, and even raw materials to run factories, the few that are still left, all of those things, commodities, if you will, go up. So we get both fire and ice at the same time. It's a controlled implosion of the warp drive. That's what we need. No, Scotty. No, we don't think we can do that. Well, they're not going to be able to do it. The controlled implosion will more or less happen simultaneously. Something will be blowing up. Something will be going down. But guess what? One way or the other, it's not a good thing. And how will all this play out? All right. Let's talk the whys here for a second. This is me suggesting that what we're probably going to see instead, and I've said this many, many times, but I think we're closer than ever, we're probably going to see war about the same time as we see hyperinflation and or hyper depression. Guess what, folks? If people have an economic problem at home, what's the best way to distract them? Yeah, we've heard it many times. The love of money is the root of all evil. And everybody that's been running countries for time immemorial knows when the economy collapses and the money fails, let's go to war. That'll distract them. When their sons die in battle, or that'll be their sons and their daughters, they'll feel less bad about having their money taken, which they're going to do anyway, or their money failing, and better that we can blame somebody else. Oh, the Russians caused it. Wasn't the Federal Reserve that did this. It was those nasty Russians. They've been blaming the weather, remember? Oh, the weather did it. That's God's fault. But now we're going to blame the Russians. All right. So here we go. This week, petrodollar alert. Here's the story. The headline tells you, and this again is something that that has been talked about. I know I've talked about it. Jeff and I have talked about it on Drive Time Friday. Putin has made one more step towards announcing the Holy Grail deal for natural gas with China. Now, if you notice, the sanction battle's been going on. The war of words that is fixing to go hot has been talked about. Obama pushed some unconstitutional sanctions. I'll come back to that in a minute. Russia is saying, you don't want to do this. You don't want to do this. We got the natural gas pipelines. Hey, Eurozone, we can cut you off. You want to freeze? Yeah, it's coming to be summertime, but we can still cut off your industries. We can cut off your natural gas. And by the way, they're fixing to do it. Natural gas prices this week in Ukraine were up 40%. I'm sure all these people that have just been saying, oh, how wonderful it is, we got our new neo-Nazi government that's overridden the elections, thank you, United States, are saying, uh-oh, we didn't think a 40% gas hike came along with that deal. Well, you guys sold us a pig in a poke like Obamacare in your country. Well, anyway, here's this story. If it was the intent, says this piece, to bring Russia and China together, if the West is looking to shoot itself in the foot, they just did. Because what Russia and China have done is brought together the two natural fits. One is a natural resource superpower. That would be Russia. They got some of the biggest oil and gas supplies in the world, and the world's biggest natural gas producer, Gazprom, and the pipelines, a lot of them run through the Ukraine and the Crimea to deliver it. And the other one is a fixed capital and labor giant, even though they got their own problems, that would be China. And if you're looking to bring them together and in the process marginalize the dollar, in other words, put an end to the almighty reserve currency of the world, and instead encourage the ruble and the yuan, or renminbi, to be engaging in bilateral trade, well then surely things are going according to plan. The story is that Russia is preparing the announcement of that Holy Grail energy deal with China, a move which would send geopolitical shockwaves around the world and bind those two nations together in a commodity-backed axis, really to prepare the way for a new world reserve currency based on commodities, bypassing the dollar. Russia implied this moments ago. This is dated yesterday. happened on Thursday then, when its finance minister, Siluanov, said that Russia may refrain from foreign borrowing this year. Who do they generally borrow from? Yeah, if you can say three letters starting with U and ending with A, you're on the right track. Refrain from foreign borrowing. And translated, that means they would bypass Western purchases of debt. And those, in turn, are usually funded by Chinese purchases of U.S. treasuries. And instead, why not just knock out the middleman, go right to the source, trade directly with China, and get rid of the U.S. dollar and its basis in U.S. debt? So what I will suggest to you, and I suggested this a couple times of late, this is so stupid. The United States sanctions are so stupid that nobody could be that stupid. It's literally like saying, look, boys, there was a scene once from a movie called Blazing Saddles. Cleavon Little holds a gun to his own head. I can't quote it because it's a politically incorrect line. He holds a gun to his own head, and he says, okay, boys, back off! Back off! Or the hostage buys it. Now, he's pointing the gun at his own head. Okay? He's going to kill him, so this is stupid. But that's exactly what the United States has done here. They're saying, hey, Russia, back off, or we'll destroy our own economy! No, you guys know we're serious. Well, they do know we're serious because the United States wants to destroy its own economy. Why? Because it's dead already. It's already coming down. The Federal Reserve knows it. Yellen knows it. They need an excuse. They need a way out. And there is no way out. They're promising to lower interest rates. No, raise interest rates. No. Oh, we just need a new lie. That's what we need. We need a war. We need somebody else to blame. Nobody's going to buy the weather as an excuse. We've been using it for too long, and it's warming up anyway. Okay, now what? Ah, blame the Ruskies, the evil commies. The evil Russian communists are more evil than the evil Washington communists. We'll blame them. We will force them to get in bed with one another. We'll literally force the Russians and the Chinese to do what they've been wanting to do all along. You guys been wanting an excuse to do this? You know darn well you want to deal with one another. We're going to give you the perfect excuse. You know what? I have to ask the question. This is so stupid, could it be deliberate, right? I asked it this way the other day. I made a mistake, and Jeff pointed it out. I think it's a cute term, even though I didn't coin it deliberately. Are they stupid or are they evil? Could they possibly be this stupid? No, they're Stuville. It's a combination of stupidity that is really motivated by evil. But ultimately what they're doing is they are looking for an excuse to blame somebody else for something they know full well is this close. My fingers are about an eighth of an inch apart. Full well about to happen. I've said this before. You know, in engineering, the old line is, if you can't fix it, feature it. If we can't fix a problem, we're going to tell you, oh, this is what we intended to do all along. Yeah, inflation? Oh, it's coming in spades. And we don't have enough of it yet. So be real happy when we get more of it. You'll know we had that in the plan. Well, of course they did. It's just they're going to tell you they're going to feed you poison and tell you it's good for you. Where have we heard that before? Just today. Ukraine is taxing deposits. This is the new Ukraine, the wonderful United States-backed utopia. They're going to pull a Cyprus. This came out early this week. The IMF's dirty little fingerprints are all over this one. Latest piece of legislation in the Ukraine where the finance ministry is going to do another Cyprus on those poor folks, taxing all deposits, 1.5%, that exceed 100,000 hryvnia. That's the current, at least, Ukrainian fake currency. I'm heading to a specific point, and I think it's hopefully going to be clear. Here's another piece. I mentioned Alistair MacLeod before. Another piece where he says, here are the implications of what's going on in the Ukraine when it comes to the gold markets. I'm going to suggest to you that if this all is part of an evil plan... Oh, are you talking a conspiracy theory, Mark? Well, ultimately, yes. Was it a conspiracy theory when the Chicago Black Sox scandal, remember that? Everybody that's seen the Shoeless Joe Jackson story. Last night I couldn't remember his name. Shoeless Joe Jackson in Field of Dreams, the Kevin Costner movie from a few years ago, right? Shoeless Joe Jackson and the Chicago Black Sox, biggest scandal in baseball history. They threw the World Series, early 1900s. I forget the exact year, 1903, 1912, I don't remember. Maybe it was 1913. A lot of the bad stuff happened that year. But anyway, sometime in the early part of the 1900s, they threw the World Series. Is that what's going on in the Ukraine? It may very well be, folks. Again, stupid is the appropriate word. Could they be this stupid in Washington? I, you know, never ascribe to conspiracy that which is explained by stupidity, but could anybody really be that stupid? Putin is clearly outplaying them in this chess game, but I think we got somebody that's deliberately giving away pawns and king, and queens and rooks and bishops in this particular chess match. We'll see why in another second, too, with another story. But here comes this piece from Alistair MacLeod, who said he is in turn relating a story from the BBC's business editor, he's going to draw a conclusion, who interviewed Hank Paulson a few years back during the Lehman crisis, when Paulson was U.S. Treasury Secretary. 1919, say the experts. Thank you. Then Secretary Treasury Paulson said he was told by the Chinese, now we're talking 2008 here, think about this, the Chinese talked to the Treasury Secretary way back then, telling him something then that I will suggest they've known for 6 years now. The Chinese had a message from the Russians. The Russians then were saying, hey, maybe they better get together, coordinate their actions to drive down the prices of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in order to, quote, maximize the turmoil on Wall Street. In other words, the U.S. economy is coming apart. If we really want to sink the American eagle, we could do that right now. The Chinese then said, nope, the pot's not ready yet to boil. Not time yet. Not time yet. The Chinese declined. But in doing so, they made it darn clear to the Treasury, we want you to be aware, Hank, that Russia and China know that between them, they have the power to break Western markets. We can destroy your economy anytime we want to. Do you know this? I will suggest, yeah, they do know this. This is why they've been holding down the price of gold and silver for those many years intervening, saying, look, as long as we continue to feed you all the gold and silver we have at the cheapest prices we can get for it, so you can unload these worthless dollars for something you like better, will you keep your mouth shut? Keep us happy. Keep us happy, debtor, and we'll stay silent for one more day, and one more day, and one more day. You just keep those markets manipulated. Give us the gold. Give us the silver. We'll just see how this plays out. Debtor is slave to the lender. You betcha. How much more so today? Now that all these intervening years have passed, oh, and by the way, a lot of analysts are saying maybe there's not much gold and silver left anyway. At the point where the cupboard is bare, does China say, okay, we weren't willing to play our card then, our Trump card, but we are now? All right. Here's where the author, Alistair MacLeod, goes into a whole discussion of NATO's geopolitical strategy. Right? And all this jazz about containment, containing the Russian bear. All of this has been exposed, he says, by Russia's unchallenged absorption of the Crimea. Assuming, if you will, for a second, that they are not ready yet to pull the plug on the hand grenade and go to a military option, in other words, punish the Russian bear by sending some more Americans to die yet, the West's financial condition, however, is just plain too fragile to withstand a financial war with the world's largest energy exporter, Russia, and the eighth largest economy, Russia, let alone a combination of Russia and China working together. Oh, wait a minute. Didn't they just put the first brick in that particular wall? Actually, it's not the first. It's like the seventh or eighth brick in that wall. America also has a problem in the Pacific containing China and their territorial ambitions. They're coming out against Japan. Remember the Senkaku Islands? Literally, these two superpowers are pushing all over the world. And they're saying, okay, the time wasn't right maybe in 2008, but it's getting really close now. We can pull the pin on this anytime we want to. China may be encouraged, given what they're seeing, to believe that the U.S. is now a pushover. At least that is the worry in Washington, where the Stouville people seem to be running the railroad. That is also why the U.S. and the U.K. seem to have gone much further than the more parochial EU when it comes to imposing these dreaded sanctions. I'm going to suggest to you there's another reason, too, against the U.S., against the Ukrainians and the Russians. The division of interest within NATO has allowed Putin, the chess player, to outmaneuver the West, and he certainly has done that. China's position should not be neglected either. Now, remember, they got their own problems. Their debt situation may be preparing to implode, so they need a war, too. Can you see how all of this stuff is beginning to come to a head? That's the real point I'm trying to make. Only this morning, this is dated yesterday, Putin publicly expressed his gratitude to China. Which means the West is not, at this instant, just confronting Russia, but potentially not only Russia, but China, as well as all the other SCO members as well. Russia's relationship with the SCO, and I'm going to look and see what that is, that's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, brings along with it the possibility of using gold as a weapon against the West. Now, I've mentioned this a number of times, folks. He who has the gold makes the rules. What's been going on with the manipulated markets? We know that the gold market's been manipulated. This has been part of the not-so-easy-to-see-through Fed strategy of keeping gold prices low, but it's kept China at least willing to play the game for a while up until there's no more gold to be had. Remember, Germany wanted their gold back. They're told, you can't have it. We're going to give it to you not this year, no, 7 years. Oh, well, we lied about the 7 years. Turns out it's going to take more like 20. You're not going to get it, in other words. But don't worry. You ain't China. You ain't Russia. We don't have to pay any attention to you. So Germany is increasingly more and more happy to sign on board with Russia. Why? They need the gas. The U.S. isn't supplying gas to Germany that keeps their homes warm and their factories running. Russia is. Well, what's furthermore, the SCO has been actively buying gold. All of the countries that make up that Shanghai Cooperation Organization have been buying gold, while the Western central banks have been not only providing it, but manipulating it to keep the price low, selling it to those that are too pig to be in the U.S. So far, the SCO members have been content to accumulate the West gold on falling prices. They've been careful not to disrupt the markets. But here's where he's headed. We can't say the Ukrainian crisis is over, and it's more likely Putin won't be fully satisfied until there's a Russian-friendly government in Kiev, too. In other words, he wants all of Ukraine. No denying that. Oh, those evil, nasty Russians. And if there's a senior Russian politician who cares to have another conversation with China about maximizing turmoil on Wall Street, hey, maybe those conversations are happening right now. Driving up the gold price is the obvious financial weapon of choice. And I'll suggest it's an indicator. In other words, people are asking, how will we know the demise of the dollar is near? Will it be inflation? Will it be deflationary depression? Regardless of what happens to the dollar per se. By the way, I personally suspect what they'll do is what they've done before. They'll try to stick it to the American people. They'll literally produce a dual dollar. A U.S. dollar where they can export the inflation overseas and punish the stupid Americans that they think won't know what's going on by splitting it. It's called a trade dollar. It's been done in the United States. They had $1 for export and another dollar for internal use. The difference was, at least at one point, those dollars were silver. And the dramatic difference is not going to be as dramatic as it is this time. So watch the gold price. When you see it get out of hand, expect that we will see economic collapse and probably nukes. But economic collapse may be enough in the near term. Meanwhile, how can the federal government in Washington profit and continue to stick it to the peons? And by the way, remember, part of the goal here is make sure that no one has the ability to get outside the system. Ultimately, you know, as another friend of mine likes to say, you know, the beast, when God commissions a beast to do his work, that's some beast. And I personally am convinced that the prophetic implications, by the way, it's not just Revelation. Revelation is consistent. There are some people say, hey, Revelation is a plagiarism. Literally all the prophet John was doing was just putting a bunch of pieces together that are described elsewhere in Scripture and saying, here's how that all plays out. Regardless of how you slice it, I think we're going to see certain things, and we can now see in the economy and in the world situation all of that coming to a head. So that's where I'm at. And that the people who are throwing the ball game here, the Washington Black Sox, if you will, are playing the game and selling people out. They're committing treason against the American public, of course. People are signing up to serve another master, all of those things we've talked about. So here's this week's latest escalation against the American people on that front. Now, this one, too, is this is another double-edged sword. It's another feint, F-E-I-N-T. Obama, warning about the potential for the dangerous risks of escalation of these sanctions of war, and absent, bothering with Congress, has signed an executive order that has authorized further penalties on a few more Russian individuals and also a bank. We're imposing sanctions, he said, on more senior officials of the Russian government. We're also announcing sanctions on a number of other individuals. Okay? Let's cut to the chase. Here's the analysis of this, because if you read the details... Oh, by the way, what did Russia respond? They laughed. They said, these are absurd U.S. and EU sanctions. This is an operetta. We can only laugh, said the Foreign Affairs Committee deputy chairman. Ha ha, you Americans. You think you're punishing us? We know what you're really doing. He did not say. You're punishing your own people. You're setting up for a coup just like our Stalin did. We've seen this before. We know what's going on here. Don't kid the kidders. Ha ha. All right, here's Max Lavo. Obama has just given himself the authority to seize your assets, the executive order. He took his pen, and the emperor made yet another proclamation. What did he do? He gave himself the power to do something that he didn't have the power to do, or to give himself the power to do either. What makes this particular instance so unprecedented and so terrifying, says Max Lavo, is that Obama went so far as to issue a new executive order to give himself authorization to do what he was doing anyway, because the laws of the United States, ha-ha, as if we still had any, are such that the government is not simply allowed to take someone's bank, assets, home, or business without due process. Well, pause. No, that's not quite true. Okay, what he's done really is he's given himself another excuse to do something that they've already unconstitutionally said they can do anyway. Case in point. Remember when some of you know this, some of you don't. I know. Give me some ones if you've heard this before. Tricky Dick Nixon. And its executive order had a lot of ones in it. It might have been like 11,111 or something, or 11,001, I don't remember. But anyway, in that sequence, a whole lot of ones in the executive order said essentially, there were a whole sequence of these things, if there's an international emergency, if we want your stuff, you U.S. citizen, you, we can just take it. We take your farm equipment, we can take your tractors, we can take your trucks, we can take your cars, we can take your vehicles, we can take your boats, we can take your airplanes, you got it, we can take it. We can take your fuel, we can take your water, we can take your food. We can take your land, we can take your bodies. Is there anything we can't take? No. If we want it, we can take it. But requires an emergency to do it. Well, we've had declared continuous emergencies since 1933. But now what they've said is we got other ways we can take it too. If you are engaged in the drug trade, we'll just charge your property with a crime and we'll take it. It's called asset forfeiture, civil forfeiture. All right? And now here comes Obama saying, hey, we like that so well, we got another way we can do it too. By the way, they can kill you. This was NDAA, Christmas Eve, a couple of years back. We'll just send a drone. We don't need no stinking due process. We can kill people. Well, if you can kill people, can't you take their stuff too? Of course. So this new executive order, he notes, back to Max Lavo, does not just apply to Russians, even though that's the way the press is spinning it, or to foreigners. It's blanket. Even American citizens, what do you mean even American citizens, especially American citizens, can now face forfeiture of their assets if their actions are deemed to be, here's the critical wording, at least part of it, contributing to the situation in the Ukraine. Oh, you said something that looks like support of the Ukrainian situation. So here's how the Ron Paul Institute puts it in their legal analysis. If you really see what this executive order says, be careful what you say. Be careful what you write. Remember, the First Amendment no longer applies. We knew that anyway. Obama has now just given himself the authority to seize your assets. Now, I'm not going to belabor this. I talked about it at some length in the Come Out of Her My People show, where I tend to do a lot more of the legal stuff. But basically, the simple, quick summary up front is, there are terms of art. In other words, the word person, if you read a Black's Law Dictionary or a Bouvier's Law Dictionary, or just talk to a lawyer, the word person doesn't mean what you've been told it means, right? We've inherited lies from our fathers. Gee, where we've heard that before. A person, in legal parlance, can include all kinds of entities created by their creator, endowed in life, with life by their creator. Isn't that amazing? Here you have Big Brother impersonating the creator of the universe. I've talked about this many times. If you read an FAA flight plan form, it asks how many souls on board, not how many persons on board. Why? Well, because a corporation is a person too. IBM is a corporation. Monsanto is a corporation. Not only that, they have infinite lifetime. They're chartered by Big Brother. They have no, there's no end to their life. They've been given infinite life. Isn't that nice? And they have a name, and they can sue and be sued, and they can engage in business. They can do all these things that a person can. I guess they can even procreate in their own subtle way. Now listen to this. Here is the text of this most recent executive order. According to the president's executive order, and it's entitled Blocking Property of Certain Persons, there's that word, contributing to the situation in Ukraine. Quote, what quotes in a second. The provisions for seizure of property extend to, quote, any United States person. Aha! What's a person? Remember, that includes corporations and other entities created by Big Brother, or those that volunteer into Big Brother's jurisdiction. There's another one of those words. That means, and now the executive order lays it out, that means, quote, any United States citizen, comma, permanent resident alien, these are people that have been given the privilege of being in the, quote, United States, unquote, right? Do you see all these terms of art? Comma, entity organized under the laws of the United States or any jurisdiction within the United States, including foreign branches. Okay, I just named all of these corporations and banks and entities and holding corporations and partnerships and you name it. Subchapter S, anything under the laws of the United States or jurisdiction within the United States. This is, by the way, not the same, not to be confused with that constitutional set of republics, right? Or any person in the United States, or any person in the United States, unquote. Well, there you go. Who does this apply to? People who have signed up to serve another master. Slavo says this new executive order crosses a very dangerous line. It's one of these turns of things that turn the notions of property rights and due process upside down, bypassing the Constitution. Well, that's true, but folks, it's yet another line that's been crossed. It's just one more way of saying, Achtung, if you have put yourselves into our camp, Mr. Person, Mr. Peon, Mr. Servant of another master, we own you. And it says what we've already known, right? Persons don't have rights. People created in the image of God have God-given rights. But American U.S. citizens don't have God-given rights anymore. They have privileges, immunities granted by their creator, who created that person. It's really subtle, and it's really nasty, and it's really evil. Next step, of course, is that persons will not be allowed to buy or sell unless they are marked as such, as lawful, legal persons. They don't have to be United States citizens. We've already seen that. You know, illegal immigrants, if they volunteer in, they can too. They can be persons. They'll eventually get to be U.S. citizens, but the key thing is that they can be persons first. That's all that really matters. Once we got you, we got you. All right. And thanks. I know we got some folks that are having to leave the room. I'm about ready to begin to wrap things up anyway. So if there's questions or comments, just make sure that you get them on the screen. What I want to do, of course, is to tie a couple of these things together. I spent a lot of time, like I said, on Thursday talking about the various isms. Nazism, fascism, feudalism, socialism, communism, and how much of that is out there. Ultimately, folks, all of this has to do with the public-private piggy partnerships of getting people to volunteer into service of another master. And it's the same thing. This is where the law, as it now has been degraded in the United States, lines up precisely with Scripture. It's part of the reason why I hearken back to this concept of a necessary but not sufficient condition. You want to be obedient to the Creator? Yeah, come out of her. But you know what? If you've got 100 different little hooks in the flesh, ways that you've signed up to serve Big Brother, another master, it ain't easy, and that is by design. That part we've already talked about. We've known for a long time. How obedient do you have to be to get the Creator of the universe's protection? You know what? I don't know the answer to that. It's up to Him. I'll suggest to you, though, what we've seen in this week's Torah portion, if you're claiming to be a priest, you better be pretty well on board. If you want to enter into his presence, you got to do it precisely the way he wants. You want to be the brides out there? Those that will, you know, enter into this wedding feast of the Lamb? If you're not keeping his Sukkot, you don't even know what the picture looks like. If you're not keeping his Sabbaths, why do you think he would invite you into the wedding tent? If you're full of piggy, same thing. All of these are necessary but not sufficient conditions. I'm gonna begin to close with a couple of comments about where we're at. Now, I've laid out a whole bunch of stuff. You know, we're talking about economics, we're talking about war, we're talking about food. I mentioned the fake vanilla, the Franken vanilla. There's a company called Evolva that is using synthetic biology, they call it. I think the name is misspelled, right? S-I-N-B-I-O. To produce something which looks a lot like a map of the DNA of real God-made vanilla, but they're doing it synthetically. That way they can patent it and get around the so-called laws. Aren't they clever? They found another dodge to the patent laws that say you can't patent a naturally occurring substance. So what they say is we'll create a synthetic way of making something that looks a whole lot like it. You can't tell the difference. Maybe God can, but we're not even going to acknowledge that he exists anyway. But we can patent it now. And not only that, we can put it in your grocery store. We can sell it in your ice cream, your Häagen-Dazs, or your, you know, whatever it may be. And by the way, if you don't know what's in there, and it says natural ingredients, they're going to tell you this is natural ingredients. But it's really Franken vanilla. It's kind of a piggy. It's masquerading as real when it's not. And they're going to lie to you and tell you that it's perfectly fine. Is it? You don't know. Oh, this stuff's getting really ugly. Well, of course it is. You know, as Harmon Taylor, the friend of mine, says, or acquaintance is probably a better way to put it. I like Harmon. When God creates, when he sets loose a beast, he sets loose the beast. This one's going to be particularly nasty. I believe that what we're going to see is the biggest deception in human history. It's climaxing. How close we are? Well, we'll see. There's probably more than one war before we're done with it. So what steps do we need to take? It's a piece from Brandon Smith of Alt Market. Now, I've read some of his stuff on occasion before. I'm gonna go through it briefly and point out to you that I think what he is describing here are a few necessary but hardly sufficient conditions. And I think he's perhaps, although he kind of alludes to it, this is a secular market that he's writing to, so I don't blame him for not having pointed all this out. I don't know what his personal take is, but I'm going to do it anyway and add the stuff that I think is also necessary among these contributing factors. So he says, what with Crimea? The referendum's passed. Yeah, Putin annexed the Crimea this week. The United States and Europe have threatened sanctions. The full extent of that's not going to be known. They're going to continue to posture and bluff and do all that kind of stuff. Inevitably, it seems to be heading towards economic warfare. Who are going to be the real victims? Of course, folks, the peons of the world. We've already seen how it is that in the name of fighting the evil Ruskies, the real threat in the United States is going to make war on its own people, just like it always had, and declare them to be the enemies, even if they think that this move is directed against the Russians. And even if at the same time they're playing the Black Sox ball game to throw the game and further tighten their leash around the slaves that have already signed up to be within their jurisdiction. Here's how Smith puts it. For those of us in the liberty movement, as he says, it's now impossible to ignore the potential threat to the economy. We've been saying that it may be someday, might be within a few years, 10 years, then eventually this will all come home to roost, we'll have to face the music. Well, now he says the threat is here. It's here now, and it's very real, and I agree on that score. I've already mentioned a couple of the things that might serve as indicators, right? Watch the price of gold. You saw, as usual this week, when it came to the FOMC meeting, they hammered it. And then they gave their trial balloon. They lied about it, made the dollar look good. Oh, they hammered gold some more. See, you don't want gold. So the whole trick of the liar is to say, you don't want something. Why don't you want it? Because I want it. And I'm going to drive the price down. I'm going to make sure that the too big to fails get it while the getting's good. And we're going to keep you out of it. There are only two possible outcomes, he says, from this point onward. I think there might be a third one, but we'll come to that in a second. But the world's reserve currency, the dollar, will destroy the only thread holding up its value, which is investor faith. We're seeing that. Russia, China, they're now preparing to exit. And when they do, they won't be the only ones. So the U.S. will be forced to default, A, because there's no no nation who wants our stinking treasury heap of you-know-what, and that would cause the dollar's value to implode. Meanwhile, the treasury's been the only ones buying the things, for the most part anyway. So far, though, the other nations that are holding them haven't dumped them. China and Russia know they can do that. So does Hank Paulson, whenever they want to. Or the Fed would choose to restart and expand their QE measures. This seems to be the popular approach that almost everybody thinks inevitably will happen. And in the process, they'll confiscate pension funds, raid bank accounts, issue new taxes. Hey, we just saw the U.S.-backed government in Ukraine doing that, right? They're pulling a bail-in, a Cyprus, on the Ukraine. Welcome to the American protectorate. Oh, yeah. All of this consequences, inevitable, an explosion in prices. Gee, maybe we're seeing that too. First in commodities and necessities, things like petroleum, imported raw materials, food, electricity, and then in all the other goods and services. They'll institute austerity measures because they are so concerned about you. They're going to put price controls in effect, all kinds of things to make sure you are safe. They'll probably sell this dual U.S. dollar, import and export, as this will make things better for you too. And of course, if you're ignorant, if you don't know what food is, and if you don't know when you're being fed poison, why would you know any better here? If events like Hurricane Katrina or New Orleans are any indication, says Brandon Smith, well, you know what to expect. So what he says is, start preparing now. Here are some things that Americans ought to be accumulating. This list you've heard before. I'll go through it very briefly for that reason. Get some food on hand at least 3 months, maybe more. Buy a water filter. Don't count on water if you're living in the cities, especially to remain functional or drinkable. Guess what, folks? When people can't flush their toilets, when the water quits running because the power's off, things get really ugly really fast. Projections of the war gaming that come from the Big Brother entities are saying, hey, most people in the United States, after a power outage or after the economic collapse, they'll die from dysentery, from the sewage that starts flowing not in the toilets and the sinks, but in the sewers, in the streets. No difference anymore. So get a water filter. Average person needs a gallon of water today. Per day. Buy a small solar kit. If you need a radio to run or something, you need a way to do it. If you need electricity to run your heater in your house and it's wintertime, how are you going to do it? Without electricity, you may find out how dismal things can get and how quickly. Store a fuel source. Remember, the U.S. government has made sure that gasoline, which used to store for years and years, now lasts less than a year. It's full of piggy products. They're not literally made out of pig. No, they're made out of genetically modified Frankencorn, ethanol. And it doesn't last. It absorbs water. It turns to varnish within less than a year. Even if you put stable in the gasoline, it'll last 2 years or so tops. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't it so planning-wise, future-oriented that the U.S. government has already figured out a way to make sure that most people's cars are dead, utterly useless within 2 years once the refineries quit working? It's almost like they had a plan, isn't it? Diesel, by the way, will last a bit longer, but it still, too, has a life limit. Find alternative shelter, he says. Make sure you have ability to defend yourself from the inevitable hordes that will be looking for somebody, anybody, to sacrifice their lives on their behalf. Make sure you have ammunition for it, too. Big Brother has already tried to make sure that you can get neither of those, obviously. Make sure that you have friends or neighbors. In other words, community. Learn some skills like bartering, things you can use to make your life useful. Medical training, gunsmithing, metalworking. Can you plant and grow crops? Can you do a number of things that others might not be able to do? Can you fix stuff? Can you grow a garden? You might need to be able to do that. Prepare your mind is as close as he gets to where I'm headed for calamity. The valuable resource you have is your own mind. The information that you have within it and the speed at which you adapt will help you to survive. Most people aren't trained psychologically to handle the stresses that are probably coming and they may die. Calm readiness equals greater success. Yeah, I think all of that is good, folks, but it doesn't go far enough. The necessary but not sufficient conditions are what matter here. If you're eating poison, if you've already weakened your immune system by eating things that are not food, is it a necessary but not sufficient condition that you might find that whatever disease that begins to run rampant, whether it's a man-made and man-released disease engineered for the purpose, which some of us just think that might be Stouffville enough to do, or just something that happened to evolve via microevolution and the overuse of antibiotics, into running rampant through a piggy population that's full of genetically modified Franken crap and stuff which is neither meat nor food. You bet. The creator of the universe promises, if you'll eat stuff that's not food, it's not going to go well with you. If you will listen to my voice, if you'll walk in my ways, if you'll eat what I tell you is food, you'll be healthier. I'll bring none of the diseases of Mitzrayim upon you. I take him at his word, and I will suggest to you that we'd better. This is a very important, necessary, but not sufficient condition. You got Christian friends that are saying, oh, I'm prepared. I got my guns. I got my gold. I'm ready. If you're eating pig, folks, you're dead. Did I say it clearly enough? If you're eating poison, you're not going to be able to keep the Sabbath for very long when what's coming is coming. How's that for blunt? These are all necessary but not sufficient conditions. These are all contributing factors, ultimately, that lead to death. Yeah, get your ammo, get your food, get your water, get in communion with your neighbors. Have the stuff on hand that you need, solar kits and so forth. Those too, they're necessary. But they ain't even remotely sufficient. Because if you are not walking in obedience to the creator of the universe, if you don't understand that it's Big Brother's protection that is not going to buy you another day when the you-know-what hits the fan, if you don't have that single necessary condition, if you're not trying to walk in obedience to the creator of the universe, the rest doesn't mean squat. He has given us his word for our blessing. I really do think that is probably the most important understanding that people can have. You put all the pieces together from this week's Torah portion. See, most of us, you'll hear Christians talk about, oh, I'm ready to be a king and a priest. Pardon my bluntness. Bull! Piggy bull! You ain't nowhere close! You don't have a clue what it takes to approach his presence because you're full of poisons. You know, you're a whited sepulcher. You can quote the things that Jesus said, and I don't think his name was ever Jesus. Never got called that while he walked this earth. But he did warn you. He said he wasn't going to change one yod or tittle of the instruction that was given for our blessing. And if somebody is, they're not serving him, period. And if someone's telling you can eat stuff that is poison to you because he said so, they're lying to you. They are the pig in sheep's clothing. The wolf in sheep's clothing. Doesn't matter. Wolf aren't. They're not food either. Don't listen to them. We've inherited lies from our fathers. So, any other final questions? We'll wrap it up there. I want to make it clear as I can. Hopefully by now it is. You can see all of these pieces coming together. Does it mean the bad stuff's going to happen tomorrow or a week from tomorrow? I don't know. Could it be that once the stuff comes into place and the peons fall in line and they sign up for yet another batch of tyranny, give up their guns and march themselves right into those camps, that Big Brother might say, oh, well, we'll feed you a little bit longer. Here, have a pig sandwich. Have some bacon. Yeah. Stay within the barbed wire. Maybe. I bet you there'll be a whole lot of people who'll say, well, you know, that's just fine. As long as he's giving me my three squares a day, I'm happy. Or at least I'm content. All animals are created equal. Some animals more equal than others. Or, well, lots of other folks have said the same thing. Remember, it was the pigs that were on top in that particular story, too. Isn't that an amazing thing? All of these, necessary but not sufficient conditions. It's not enough to just walk a little bit in obedience. Not enough just to keep Sabbath. Not enough just to say, okay, I'm going to not eat pig anymore. We got to continue to try to walk as we come in the gate, as we learn his instruction, as we begin to see how the pieces fit in place, we can do a better and better job. To him, you know, who much is given, much is expected. We've got an increasing obligation. As things get uglier and uglier, folks, we're going to have to be able to teach the difference between the tahor and the tamei, the clean and the unclean. And so hopefully today you've got some additional ammunition, some other things that'll help us to do that and to walk in obedience. Understand the difference between the necessary and not sufficient conditions. And finally, I think it helps to understand what it is that got Nadab and Abihu killed. Maybe it was hubris. But ultimately, they tried to go into his presence on their terms, is the way I think really it boils down. We got to learn that it's entering into his presence on his terms that matters. He's the husband's, he's the singular husband. We want to be the bride's plural. I don't get to decide what other brides have to do if they want to enter into his presence. He writes the rules. None of us do. Period. You want to go into his presence? Ask him how. And he's written a lot of it out for us. Nadab and Abihu may have been in a position where they should have known better. I'm not going to claim that I know what they didn't know. I probably don't know nearly as much as they did. But I do know what's written. And I do know that those things that he's written for us are, again, the necessary but not sufficient conditions. So, bear that in mind. May Yahuwah bless you and keep you. May Yahuwah make his face to shine upon you. May Yahuwah lift up his countenance upon you and give you his shalom. And folks, may he give us all eyes to see and ears to hear. May he bless our walk as we attempt day by day to be more in obedience with him, to conform our will to his, and to be doing the things that he has for us to do. May we be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming and to be called good and faithful servants. May that be true of each of us. Hallelujah. Shabbat shalom.
Just spiritual need.